about Detroit.
Welcome to WRAF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Thank you very much. Welcome to all of you. Julene, hi.
Yes, hi, Peter.
How are you doing?
Oh, great.
We just played that Led Zeppelin classic, Communication Breakdown.
It sounded great, didn't
it? Yeah, it did. It's great music, but I was thinking, I don't know, we ought to use that on the program.
Yeah, no doubt.
Too. Well, welcome. If everybody, there's always somebody that just happens by this for the first time in,
you know, 42 years.
Yeah, but still, you know, we're this WRIF known literally nationwide and with the internet probably worldwide for the incredible rock and roll it puts out. But for a couple, 3 hours every Sunday night, we do a talk show.
That's right.
At different times. It's been even overnight, all night, five and six hour shows.
It's all talk.
Back in the day. Yeah, way back in the day. But here's what you do.
You had to work really hard.
Yeah. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number.
313-298-9743.
Bring up something you're interested in, but maybe kind of wait and see what we're up to. But, you know.
But hey, if you're chomping to talk about things, go for it.
Mostly it's political, but we are going to talk about the Tigers. Should we talk about the weather? It's a cold snap. Three quarters of the country. It's 10 to 30 degrees colder.
Well, I guess
that proves there's no global warming.
We get that every year.
Yeah.
Particularly from one certain person we work with here.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
He says it every year.
Yeah. Hey, it's getting cold. Winter has come.
Guess the DJ.
Oh, yeah, I guess I can. But one of the things, and as soon as you hear these words, listen to the words following this, because as soon as I say this, I get a feeling that some people may just turn off. But everyone I saw during the week would say, so what'd you think about the debate?
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I heard a lot about it.
So I said,
I couldn't get away from people.
I said, I don't know. I didn't watch it.
Right, but you know what happened.
Well, I guess.
Yeah, did you see any clips whatsoever?
No. Well, a little, but it didn't.
Yeah.
No, next to nothing. I mean, here's the headline in the New York Times. Debate prays for Romney as Obama is faulted as flat. Now, I'm saying I don't want to talk about this, and I'm starting. What I want to talk about is the Detroit police at the Detroit Tigers game, the art and entertainment in Detroit, and how this is all wrapped in together. Maybe even wrapping it in with the debate.
Wow,
Jolene's looking at me. Are you really going to be able to do
really
this?
Really tying all that together. Okay.
Now, I need
go
you.
For it.
I need you to, you know, when I start getting all these different threads, I sometimes don't pull them back together.
You know, my job is to help focus you.
Right. One of the things, here's what I think about the debate. It is not even a political, political act. It's some reality show. And it's this media scam to keep everybody watching all the time. Because, I mean, think about it. Apparently, and I really did not see any of it, apparently Obama did not do well. He didn't pick up on the things that he and the Democrats believe are.
Yeah, he kind of just was leaving some things out. Not really just going for it.
And saying, we agree, you know. And
but
whatever. So,
I think he was trying not to be the angry dude.
Yeah, well, but one of the things that all of the media, newspapers through to, you know, the modern media, the 21st media, their main task in life is not to inform us, but to keep us listening or watching or whatever.
Ratings and
money. Ours too.
Yeah, ratings and money.
Actually, that's actually not true. There's a lot of things I wouldn't talk about if it was just all about popularity. I mean, really, I'd like to think this is a show about ideas and exchange of ideas.
Yeah. This
and,
is different.
Yeah, we're different. Everybody else sucks. We're different. But in any event, so I really tend to stay away from it because I figured that it would only be, you know, BS and platitudes, right?
Yeah.
And apparently, from everything I could read about, essentially that what it was. And here's what I was thinking. There was some nitwit. How did I see this on Fox News? Maybe I said, you know what? I think I saw it on Media.
And to hear you say those words.
I think it was Media Matters.
Okay.
MediaMatters.org. They had a clip of it. And somebody from Fox News, they were going on about what a fake Obama was.
That just you know how he was a fake? Make any sense. Why?
Because the way he walked and,
really?
And the way he ran, you know how he always like walks real, you know, he very athletically goes up or down stairs.
Yes.
And he said, that's just a fake. He's got his shoulders all raised, and I'm thinking.
People are grasping. Are they not?
They really
They're
need
disgusting.
To.
They're disgusting.
Yeah, I mean, here's what it's all about, folks. It's about policy. What policies are these two candidates and these two parties going to put forth that are going to affect us and our families and our communities? Because I was thinking, I mean, now they say, you know, the Romney campaign has been reinvigorated.
I know.
And everybody, I mean, you know.
I actually had people tell me that they decided not to vote for, one person told me they decided for sure they're not voting for Obama. And then on the other side, I had people telling me, you know what, I just really love that man. I, you know, and some people I don't like either. It's all over, but.
Well, one of the things I was thinking, and this happens sometimes in Europe. I mean, what if you had, I mean, you know, speaking of Fox News, I mean, where do they get all these women? They all look like kind of porn stars. You know,
yeah, they're porn-esque.
They're porn-esque. And so, you know, so we come to expect someone very, very attractive. And actually, both of these candidates are, you know, am I giving Romney
no,
too much?
Well,
he's a distinguished looking man in
yeah,
that kind
I don't
of
find
wealthy,
him attractive
wealthy,
at all,
wealthy ruling
it.
Class.
My mom has the hots for him.
Well,
so,
yeah, yeah. She's a, Republican. Maybe she can. No, he's married. Isn't he? Anyway, where was I in this? Oh, yeah, yeah. So what if, so we come to expect,
ass.
We come to expect beauty. On television.
Yes.
And what if the head of the Democrats, either a president or a presidential candidate, was a middle-aged or older woman, kind of, quote, frumpy looking, in other words, not all done up the way these Fox News porn stars are, and wasn't real good with words.
Right.
And she, but here with this, I mean, one of the things about Romney, you got to remember, I mean, he has that poise that comes of wealth and privilege
yeah.
and expectation.
And years of doing what he's
yeah,
done,
yeah.
too.
And having control over people, of always being at the top of things, on top of things and what have you. So, all right, so say you had Mitt Romney, say there was, you know, Obama, let's say this is 2016, and that, so Obama isn't running it, and the Democrats put forward, well, you know, I mean, and I'm not trying to cast aspersions on anyone's looks, but like Debbie Stabenow, no one's going to be, you know, I mean, she's an older woman, old,
yeah.
you know, late middle age.
She's not a porn star. Let's
she's
just
not
put
a porn
it that
star.
Way.
And actually, she is well spoken. But what if she wasn't? I mean, it's what kind of policies does she have? I mean, so what if someone is glib and on the offensive and, you know, called somebody out and all that?
Right.
I mean, what a load of crap.
I
know,
it really
and
is.
That's why I didn't watch any of it
it's
and
another,
didn't care about
it's
it.
It's another one of those non-issues that's become a huge issue
all
this
right.
week.
Let's get to Detroit City. Boy,
yeah.
Here are the Tigers. 2-0 in the playoffs
yes.
with the Oakland A's. Another game under the belt. And the most odd phenomena occurred, although I understand completely. My union brothers in the Detroit Police Officers Association, I'm in the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, and here's the article that appeared in the Detroit News, also one from CBS. They both have some interesting things on it. While the Tigers prepared to take on the Oakland Athletics inside Comerica Park Saturday, and you know, they used to sing God Bless America, like I think at the seventh inning. Now they sing God Bless Comerica.
I've been to a game. I don't remember that. Wow, I wasn't paying attention.
God bless Comerica.
Oh,
bank or where I bank. I don't know.
Right,
anyways,
okay.
Members of the Detroit Police Officers Association passed out flyers to, quote, let the public know they entered Detroit at their own risk. So they're talking about the mostly suburban crowd that comes down for the sporting events, the downtown Detroit, for those of you who aren't in the area. There's the Lions play at Ford Field, and right next to it, right near it, is
and I think
Comerica Park.
Yeah, and their point is they are understaffed.
Yeah.
And
300 officers in civilian clothes handed out flyers urging people to vote against the emergency manager law ballot proposal, and we can talk about that later, and for the collective bargaining ballot proposal as fans headed to watch game one that they won. Both these games have been thrillers. Great. But what they're talking about, folks, is there's this emergency manager law that that someone comes in and just negates the contracts that have been
the
signed.
Union. I mean, yeah. They're already at the point where they took the 10% pay cut. And
the police did,
and,
yeah.
And they're working these 12-hour shifts. In fact, I don't know if I told you that, Peter, but my boyfriend is his brother is a Detroit cop.
Right.
And the other day he said, yeah, my brother's going in. He's got to do a 12 to 12. I mean, they're doing 12-hour shifts under, you know, and their job isn't really...
Yeah, it's not like...
easy.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say...
It's physically demanding.
Yeah.
And you need to be awake to deal with these situations.
And, yeah, and there's a lot of tension. There is crime in the city of Detroit, and these guys shouldn't be working 12 hours. And I can't believe that a judge could uphold the right of this emergency manager to impose, essentially break this contract.
Our union contract.
Hey, what happened with contracts? I mean, I thought that was the basis of capitalist business relationships.
Yeah.
You know, say, well, I can't afford it anymore, so I'm not going to pay you.
Right.
I mean, you know, you can't do that.
No.
So I don't get it. The DPOA, the police officers, union, they're currently at odds over a new contract which calls for a 10% pay cut and 12-hour shifts for officers. And the union has 2,130 members, and the city is broke, which is another question which we will get to in a little while.
It's a mess.
Yeah, let's see. Okay. Here, this is the police union says war-like Detroit. It says, the men and women of the Detroit Police Department believe the city is too dangerous to enter. Now, they really don't believe that, folks.
No, this is their way of saying we need more officers and we need what we deserve, what we signed the contract for.
Detroit Police Officer Association attorney Donato Iorio said Detroit is America's most violent city. You know, I don't believe that's the case. Its homicide rate is the highest in the country. I don't think that's the, I mean, it's up there. It's a big
it's
urban city.
Detroit, yeah. Miami.
Camden. Yeah.
Yes.
LA.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, cities like that. I mean, it's nothing to, you know, you start bragging about, are you number three or number four? It's still, you know, a few hundred people every year get murdered.
Yeah.
Let's see. Iorio says the once 2,000-strong force is shrinking rapidly. Hundreds of officers have left the force, and one of them said the only thing that's going down in Detroit is their pay. These are the men and women, he says, who we look to protect us. The police officers can't protect you if they're not there. Officers are leaving simply because they can't afford to stay in Detroit and work 12-hour shifts for what they're getting paid. You know, I mean, that's a nutty argument. I mean, they made a contract. I mean, they can afford to stay. I mean, all the arguments here are bad ones.
And it says that at this part, you know, this is really what's going on. These police are demoralized.
That's true.
They're leaving hand over fist because they can no longer afford to stay on the department and protect the public.
I don't know why they can't afford to.
Well, they took the 10% pay cut.
Yeah.
And these are people like in this economy. Hey, a lot of people, the majority of people are barely making it.
Yeah, and they're not highly paid. So what they're doing, what they're applying to other forces. Here's where I think they made a real mistake. Right now, Detroit is on a real high. And when we say Detroit, folks, particularly if you're not in this area, we just don't mean the confines of the city itself. If people are from Sterling Heights or Taylor or Oak Park or the Burbs, anywhere in the Burbs, and someone says, where are you from? They say, Detroit.
Yes.
You know.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
that's what I say.
Yeah, you just say you're from Detroit. So the majority of people that come down to these sporting events, again, are from the suburbs. And what the Detroit Police Officers Association is saying is extremely righteous in terms of protesting against what's being done to them. The abrogation of the contract, the attempt to force upon them. Essentially what they're trying to do is break the union. Like they did in Camden. They fired all the cops in Camden, and they're going to replace them with guys making $9.75 an hour.
And Camden, as we said, one of the highest murder rates
You're going to be having people out on the streets with little training, making $10 an hour. Gee, you think they might take part in a little corruption?
Yeah.
to supplement, getting, about $20,000 a year, and give them a nine-shot, pistol. Gun, automatic pistol. So here's where, though, I think that they didn't look good. I mean, first off, There is no danger, next to no danger whatsoever for any of us coming into. Well, you know what? I'm going to change my mind.
No, I'm changing whatsoever.
My mind. No, well, in any realistic terms, wherever you go, I mean, there's.
I know.
There's.
I go downtown all the time.
So do I.
I was down there yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, if you read the responses in the Detroit News or CBS News in Detroit. I mean, it's like open season for every idiot racist in the area.
Yeah, absolutely.
You better not go down there unless you got your gun.
Yeah.
So tell that to the tens of thousands of people that were at the Detroit baseball game. Either of them, Saturday and Sunday, where the Tigers beat the Oakland A's.
No one seemed to be in fear.
Yeah, and Friday and Saturday night, there was this incredible display all through what's called the cultural... what's it
district?
Called? District, yeah, the cultural district. D-Electricity, Detroit's nighttime exhibition of art and light.
You mean you were there after dark?
After dark.
Wow,
and wow, it was wonderful. Absolutely wonderful down there. Again, thousands and thousands of people walking around Woodward and Warren and Forrest and Garfield. And I can't even begin to tell you. First, it began with a bike ride from probably 500 or 600 bikes, all lit up with these, glowing lights.
That's so cool.
Overlooking it all was a guy with a little drone that he was operating, that was all
really?
Glowing. Yeah, it was amazing. And then this huge bike ride took off, and it was right near Wayne State University, and it headed up to Woodward. And the nicest little part of it was a whole bunch of people had these letters that spelled out shared Detroit,
mm-hmm.
and the D was shared, so the D
yeah.
and the,
oh, I love it.
Yeah, was in, and the bikes were just incredible.
There's a lot of pride in this city.
They had
things like that.
Huge block party with on Canfield and Woodward with food trucks and fire dancers and fire eaters and
cool.
Yeah, and everybody had lights on and there were children there, and so. Union brothers and sisters in the DPOA, that's a bad tack to take, to tell people that it's dangerous to come into. You know where it's dangerous if you live in Detroit.
Well, yeah, and the thing is that it was the tactic, and I think a lot of people get it, but some people won't get it. That's the danger to me, is that people will take that flyer and think the opposite of what they were trying to get accomplished.
Actually, I wrote, they had this whole just dialogue going, these comments on CBS Detroit.
Yeah.
They were so hideously racist. These people are, where do they get every mean man, every mean
yeah.
white man from the suburbs that gets the right in? Before these
I read some of those. It's frightening.
Yeah, before these guys, just had to kind of think it. But now they actually can express their horrible opinions.
Yeah.
So I wrote in and I said, they're right. I said, be afraid. Be very afraid. Don't come to Detroit. Stay home and watch television. I said, parking spots are getting harder and harder to get in Detroit. And so I'm thinking, like now I'm probably encouraging people to come down, and you should. All the cultural stuff, the
wonderful.
Opera, the rock concerts, all the restaurants. What?
Sports.
The sports and all this stuff that's going on around, what's that area on Michigan where the old train station. Is.
Oh, yeah, Corktown.
Yeah, Corktown stuff. They've got the new thing called the Sugar Hill District, which is around southeast of Forest and Woodward. All these restaurants and galleries, and
mm-hmm.
we were through all of those. It was just amazing. I can't remember the last time I was so high being in this, on the city.
Right, yes, high on the city.
Yeah.
Well, there's, like I said, there's a lot of pride. I love this city, and even for people who in my life who aren't from Michigan or Detroit, they'll bring sometimes negative things up about it. But I think that the view of Detroit around the country has changed. I really do. I think they're seeing that all of this is going on. There have been articles in the New York Times, right?
Sure.
So there's been a lot of exposure.
Yeah.
But the thing that I wanted to add about the police is that there are 1,000 fewer police officers today than there were 10 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's
I know.
Astounding.
Well, one of the things that we should make clear, I don't want to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. Like most urban cities, not all, but most urban cities, there's real problems. Because of the wealth that has flowed to the 1%, cities are going broke all over the country.
And then the emergency manager situation.
In Michigan, there's something called the emergency manager thing, where if cities really get in a terrible problem, a manager is appointed, and then they can just, like I say, break all these contracts. And these are Republicans supported because they want to destroy public worker unions, teachers' unions, and everybody else that works so hard and over the years has gotten a middle-class living. On the other hand, that the wealthy are getting wealthier and wealthier and wealthier, where the Detroit police literally are begging. Can you imagine that? I mean, the indignity of it. I mean, that's awful.
It really is.
In fact, I'm wondering if there are Detroit police officers listening. They're very sympathetic to the fact that the city should not be allowed to just unilaterally alter a contract and to make people work 12 hours. I mean, can you imagine that?
I remember reading that and hearing about it, but then it was right there in my face with someone who knew someone who was getting ready to go do it, and I just thought that is horrible.
Yeah, it is bad. My complaint was, I just think that it was a bad tactic to say. But here, let's go back.
You know what? I wouldn't even want to sit. This job is not, and when I DJ as well, music, it's not physically demanding or anything, but I don't want to sit there for 12 hours. Oh,
that would be amazing.
God.
Yeah. But let's get back to one thing again. They are completely wrong in telling people coming from the suburbs that they're at risk to come into the city of Detroit.
Maybe they're coming from a different point of view, Peter, and they think they really are.
Well, every city, has tourists and people that come to, urban areas. Yeah. Well, there's crime. I mean, that's the nature of the urban area. It's, you go back to the 1830s and 1840s. I mean, that the big cities were just the most horrible things in the world. I mean, they're peaceful and good and nice and clean compared to what they were 150 years ago or whatever that turns out to be. But where the people are suffering is the residents, the poor residents of the city of Detroit. That's where the killings take place. I mean, that's what happens among poor people. You can go to poor people, among poor people, poor districts, poor areas, anywhere in the world, any continent, any race, any religion, you name it, and there's violence, there's broken families, there's great amounts of mental illness, there's habits where the people who aren't in the lower classes say, well, if they only would pay a little, take responsibility for their own life.
Right.
Hey, who said that? Oh, yeah, Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So
that in mind.
The behavior that we associate with the poor is a definition of the poor. That's the way the poor act. That's the script they act out all around the
it's
world.
It's survival, man.
Well, it's not even.
A lot
of it is, well, yeah, crime. But here, let me tell you, folks. Some people, like I say, all these racist idiots that were commenting on these news sites.
Mm-hmm.
We're lucky so far because the poor in Rio de Janeiro, in places like Johannesburg and Kingston and other cities like that, they're armed to the teeth.
Mm.
Where in sometimes in these shanty towns in these very, very poor countries, the cops will only patrol in units of six with fully automatic weapons and all that. And often they're met by gangs similarly armed. And in lots of districts like that, they simply leave it to be run by the criminal elements there.
Wow.
And so we're lucky, folks. This is the good old days so far. But if things keep tumbling down like this, if we allow the 1% to keep sucking this economy dry of wealth and denying any kind of distribution of it to other people, that's going to be ahead.
Or taking it away what is already there in place.
A friend of mine worked in Sao Paulo in Brazil, the capital, and they had a deal on their ATM machines. They had a limit of $400. And there was rampant kidnapping of middle class and upper class and foreigners and tourists.
At the ATMs?
Anywhere.
Okay.
And that would happen. And he got picked up. Just these guys, all of a sudden he had a gun in his back. He was in the back of a car. And they said they just took him to the ATM machine. He took out $400, gave it to him.
It was over.
Okay, bye. If you put your limit at like $50 or something like that, they cut off your finger.
Oh my God. Don't want to lower the limit.
Yeah. So it's like a business deal. You know, if you're not smart enough to avoid the kidnappers of Sao Paulo, you either lose $400
or a finger.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So as long as you have this.
We are lucky.
Yeah. So as long as you have this maldistribution of wealth the way you have in this country, that's what generates crime. You know, they have all these criminologists. A friend of mine was a like the chair of a criminology department, actually at Wayne State here in Detroit and then in Florida. And he says, you know, they do study after study after study of what causes criminal behavior. He said, anybody knows, it's mostly poor people that commit violent crimes. You know, there's an old Woody Guthrie song, Pretty Boy Floyd, in which there's a line, he says, some man will rob you with a six gun, other with a fountain pen. I mean,
right.
The criminals robbing us with fountain pens set the context for the people that will rob you with a six gun, right? So as long as you have classes of poor, hey, I'll quote other rock songs and early Dylan songs.
You're on a roll.
A man ain't got nothing, he got nothing to lose, right?
Mm.
And as long as you start shoving people way to the margins of society, why in the world would you expect him or her to follow the rules that are set for the people that have a stake in it?
Right.
So right now, what we're doing is we're creating the context for a huge criminal class. The other thing is, people in Detroit, where I've lived and lived in Highland Park and what have you, I never could get a figure in my head, and you've heard me say this before, probably 95, maybe even 98% of the people are law-abiding, care about their homes, their families, and what have you. But if you have 2 to 5%, particularly young men involved in criminal activity, it's almost unlivable. There.
Yeah.
You start having, like Detroit has, 400 people being murdered, carjacking, home invasions, everything under the sun like that. Because, you know, people create subcultures of crime where there's respect granted to the people at the top. And also, of course, it's what sociologists called innovation. You can't get your money through the regular sources that society, you know, provides for you. So you innovate. You say, okay, I'm going to go stick up people. I'm going to stick up a gas station. I'm going to, you know, do stuff like that.
Hey, Dave in Colorado is listening. Hello, Dave.
Hey, Dave. Way back, way out in Colorado.
And he said that Pine Bluff, Arkansas, is the most dangerous city.
With Native Americans.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Huh. Now, why would they have those conditions? Huh. Hey, you know, I forgot about this. Here, someone wrote me, and a person named Carol. And this is the kind of racist stupidity that you get about Detroit. She wrote to me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hey, I just finished reading a great article about racial violence and mayhem in Detroit. I know that sounds like a dog bites man story. You know, that means an ordinary one. But even for Detroit, this is strange. It was written by one of my favorite writers, and then gives the name, whose book about racial violence is just the best thing out there on it. Now, that would be a great story for you to cover and, you know, to have an interview. So what it was, it says, the headline was, Black Mob Invades, I actually don't have this in front of me. Let me see if it's here. Black Mob Hijacks Store Saying We Own This.
Right.
So I Googled it, and I found it on this far right wing racist website.
Yikes.
Which I won't give the name. And so, but I looked everywhere. I searched Detroit News, Detroit Free Press, and what have you. And there's been cases of that sort of flash mobs of young African Americans have gone into like 7-Eleven and just grabbed everything that's not tied down. I mean, it's sort of, you know, teenage misbehavior in lots of ways. But when white suburbanites see that, it scares the hell out of them.
Sure.
Know? Right. I was thinking, in fact, here's what I wrote back. Carol, what did you think was great about this article, if in fact the incident actually occurred? I searched all over the internet for some reporting of it and could only find it in two far right wing news sites, including the one you mentioned. However, if true, what does this tell you? Racism is the dog whistle of the right to frighten whites into voting for corporate elites like the Koch brothers through their stooges such as Romney. Now, you know, I told this to my wife, dog whistle, what are you talking about? Dog whistles have such a high pitch that only the dogs can hear.
Yeah.
Now, racists in this country do, you know better than to say, well, they're inferior, or, you know, or use the N word. I mean, they do themselves.
Right.
Yeah, when they're
not
by themselves.
In conversation with people who are not racist.
So if you look at these right-wing sites, they're just filled with this kind of stuff. So I wrote, if this is a real incident, it wouldn't surprise me because stuff like this happened. People, I guess I just said this, people forced onto the margins of a society, whether in Detroit, Jakarta, Juarez, Kingston, or Dar es Salaam, act outside of the boundaries of expected behavior. In the other cities, the poor are heavily armed and take a greater toll than what is reported in this story. But what we see in Mexico, for instance, could easily begin to occur here if we keep impoverishing huge swaths of our population. The account, true or not, is racist to the core. The identity of the mob, designated in racial terms, is the giveaway. If it even happened, it was a mob of the poor. The Romneys of the world will assure this continues and with greater intensity.
Yeah, I thought that was a great response.
Yeah, and I said, please answer the questions in the first paragraph.
And she never has, right?
No,
the shame on her. Shame on this woman.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking later that maybe she was actually a publicist trying to lure me into interviewing this author.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it could have been.
Your thoughts on this?
A racist publicist.
Yeah. Yeah. So, folks, what do you think? Here we got our Tigers poised on the edge of victory.
Of victory.
Best 3 out of 4. Hey, by the way, remember I was saying earlier what a media scam these debates are because they always want you to listen to the next one? Okay. If you were the media, would you rather have the Tigers sweep or actually have it go to the fifth game? I mean, you know, would you rather have 3 games or 5 games?
Well, if you're the media, you want to
five
stretch
game.
As long
yeah.
as possible. This, there's some dollars in
there. Yeah, I mean,
there.
You could have, you know, the score, the game score is tied at 2-2. I mean, think about how many people
would be watching.
So it's the same thing with these
debates.
Romney debates. So if there are any Detroit police officers, I'd like to hear what you have to think about this. People, whether
And what you thought about the debate. I mean, I think that's kind of...
Anybody want to talk about the debate? I didn't even see it. So, if Obama did badly, I mean, it doesn't affect me one way or the other.
Right. Yeah. Doesn't me either.
All right, got some open lines. We'll be right back. Mike from Fenton thinks the police in Detroit are too expensive. We'll talk to him and you when we come back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after the...
Clipping coupons. Standing in line at 4 a.m. Buying 5 to get 1 free. Maybe it's me, but I don't think it should be that hard to save money. Which is why we made Geico.com so easy. Just a few clicks and you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance. And when you switch to Geico, you can do practically everything online. Report a claim, update your policy, even pay your bill. Click Bam Boom. Visit Geico.com today. Click Bam Boom. I'm rather fond of that one.
Hey, dog, where's your owner?
Watching Netflix.
Yeah?
He can instantly watch as many TV episodes and movies as he wants online.
Well, I know what you did on my lawn, and it's not funny.
It is the kids.
Well, what are their parents supposed to laugh at?
The sophisticated jokes. You know, like, that dog chasing his tail reminds me of politicians.
Oh. Instantly watch as many TV episodes and movies as your family wants on all kinds of devices for only $8 a month with Netflix. Start your free trial today. See terms of use.
Running a small business means just that, a lot of running, a lot of things to do. So take one more thing off your to-do list. Get Carbonite Online Backup. Carbonite backs up your computer files for you, automatically and continually. For only $229 a year, Carbonite backs up all the computers and external drives at your small business. Try it free today at Carbonite.com. No credit card required. Use offer code PROTECT and get 2 free bonus months with purchase. Carbonite.com. Offer code PROTECT.
Thanks for rocking with the Riff online. This is WRIF.com.
You think that you're insane? WRIF for your chance to join Ann Carlini, Meltdown, Screamin' Scott, and Riff Rock Girl Juliet, partying and broadcasting live from the Strip at the newly renovated Flamingo Las Vegas. Join Screamin' Scott live with Chun Li from TV's Pawn Stars at the famous Gold and Silver Pawn in downtown Las Vegas. Rock out in the official Riff section as Guns N' Roses performs live at the joint inside the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino. The best part? You won't care what time Axel walks on stage, because it's Vegas. WRIF Sin City Takeover 2012. Presented by Elias Financial. Call 1-800-CALL-WILL. Total Rewards Resorts in Las Vegas. Also by Taco Bell. Live Las. Get more info and your Riff Cyber Crew totally unfair internet advantage at WRIF.com. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
Thank you. Welcome back. Got some phone calls waiting. You can join us 313-298-WRIF. If you want to comment on the debate, something I didn't even watch, couldn't care less about them. Think they're a distraction and what have you. But I'm curious whether you think they're worth watching. And are they just a reality show? We're also talking about the Detroit Police Officers Association, a union with righteous grievances against the city because they've been ordered to work 12-hour shifts. They have a 10% pay cut. And they leafleted the Detroit-Oakland Athletics playoff game saying, warnings, enter Detroit at your own risk. And Jolene and I are saying for people that visit Detroit, no problem. Very, very little crime. And, you know, if you got stuck up or mugged or something like that, don't bother to call because, you know, it does happen. You know, it happens. There are people.
It happens in every city. In every city, town.
Yeah. But generally, it's completely safe. The people that are really at risk are the citizens themselves, because in any poor community, people prey on one another. A small section of the people actually prey on the rest of people. There's a lot of violence. Among poor people, there's an incredible level of mental illness. The humiliation about being poor is worn pretty heavily by most people in that situation. It's high stress being poor. Mm-hmm. It's a terrible condition, and it's being exacerbated, being made much, much worse by the financial policies of this country, and it will even worsen more under this Romney-Ryan budget, although, you know, Romney's kind of trying to move away from this
stuff. Yeah, he's trying to be.
Yeah. You know, and his wife said, oh, it showed what a good human being he was.
Oh, please!
I mean, but people have a problem with distinguishing between reality and fiction as it is. I mean, think about how blocked or people get into fictional characters on television.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when you're debating, you're acting. You know, I've debated.
It's very true.
It's an act. All
right. Very true. Let's go to the phones, Peter.
All right. Here is Mike. Mike's in Fenton. Mike, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Good.
Good. Hello, Mike.
Hey. I think it's with the police. There's a couple things. Some of them facts that you were given were a little askew about the poor people. So I'd like to talk about that a little bit. But the
go ahead.
But I'll address those police officers first. Would that be okay?
Sure, but do it quick.
All right, it's a public safety issue. A lot of these guys are leaving because they can't afford to work here because other places will pay them for more money, so they don't want to stay.
Right.
And then the thing is it being a public safety issue, the state has a responsibility and they have a surplus. There's not as much crime in Oakland County and some of the other suburbs. So they have a responsibility of being good people that they say that they are, that they're so concerned about the crime in Detroit, to make sure that they put an end to it. So we don't have to keep listening to this for the next 20 years. So it lies on their shoulders, not the poor people.
What are you talking about? Mike, what are you talking about? I mean, one of the things is that if there's a balanced budget or a surplus in the state of Michigan, because, you know, one of the things that's happened is there's less revenue sharing with the cities under Snyder, and he's used that to balance the budget. So, and I mean, you think that very many of the cities in Oakland County care about Detroit?
No, I know that's what I'm saying is I know they don't, but they can't complain and say that they can't go to Detroit and there's too much crime in Detroit.
Oh, I gotcha.
We gotta be known.
All right, well, tell me about the poor people in Detroit. I want to hear this.
Okay, we gotta be known all over the world as a bad city that has high crime, when in all actuality, the 1%, the people that can afford to take care of it, have all the money in their pocket, and so the poor people that are suffering there and are having the crime and being blamed for the crime, the real blame goes on the people that have the money and that are keeping the money and that are created this issue of these people not having these jobs. So, the thing is, you know, like I say, the number are skewed and they're misleading people by the way they present this. The correct way to present it is they've taken the money and they put it on what they want to, and they put the public in danger, and now they've got no jobs and these poor people are desperate, and yeah, they're doing more crimes just like you said, because they're having mental issues because they can't deal with everything. And so it's the people out here in the suburbs that we should get this handled and put an end to this. And so this any kind of excuse that we keep using.
Well, I'll tell you, Mike, I don't think it's a matter that those of us, for instance, like I do and Jalene does, live in Oakland County, or you, if you're, let me see, where are you, Fenton? That's not Oakland County. But, you know, if these people have so much incredible amount of money, and there was just a list came out, you know, the Forbes 400, the richest people in the world. Well, as it turns out, and suddenly I can't find that, but that there are these billionaires in the in Michigan who, guess what, as things go to hell in Detroit and a lot of the suburbs, they can't even afford to keep the basic services going at the level that we all need, the billionaires in Michigan, their fortunes have increased. Well, I will look for that. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that comment. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Eric in Roseville. Eric, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, sir. Good evening.
And the inescapable conclusion that I came to from the debate was that Mr. Romney could step into any corporation on the planet Earth and make it a success, whereas I call that thing running against him wouldn't be qualified to work in a mailroom. And
what?
I'm gonna.
It ever occur to you to maybe take
a mailroom?
Take the dialogue and put it in some human terms rather than disparaging people. You know, Romney got wealthy. Yeah, he could probably go into any corporation in the world, buy it all up, sell it off. what do they call it? They ship the jobs overseas and take the profits and put them in the Cayman Islands, right?
I mean, it's one thing if you don't like Obama. I get that, but. You know, really, I mean, don't you think, do you really think he's not qualified to have a really good job?
No, he's an empty suit, can't even speak on his feet.
Then Romney's an empty suit.
Yeah, well, Romney, of course, is an empty, very, very expensive suit. Well,
yeah, true.
You want to pray at the feet of the ultra-wealthy, pal, go right ahead. I mean, he's just going to make the economy that much worse because they have nothing. What do they have for a plan? What's their big jobs plan? I heard him today saying he was going to create 25 million jobs. How's he going to do that?
Yeah, please, explain why. Don't just say you're going to. Say how.
No, very simple. If your heart's in the right place, instead of being a left-wing socialist, you know how to create wealth.
Well,
the marketplace and capitalism does every day without the interference of, I would say, quote-unquote, you people who don't know anything about economics.
Well, you don't know anything about economics.
Let me ask you this, Peter. You must be, like, rolling in the dough. Huh?
You must be a rich man, huh?
Well, I have to tell you, I live in the suburbs without much wealth here, but I do have to admit that I'm 1/5 owner of $1.5 million ranch in Wisconsin.
Well, that's good.
Okay, well, see, you're predictable. I was able to predict that.
No, that's good because you are voting your class interests because the Romney-Ryan plan will provide more and more wealth to the 1%, which it sounds like you're either part of or close to. So it would make a lot of sense for you and the other 1% of the people that are similarly situated in this country to do so. I mean, oh, that Obama was a left-wing socialist. I would be backing him with great enthusiasm.
Yeah, because he's not at all.
Rather than just wanting to, make sure that Romney doesn't get anywhere near the levers of power.
He's a centrist, basically.
So what I don't understand, though, is why anybody in the 99% would want to vote for Romney. Because what he's essentially talking about is the same failed policies of George Bush and of Ronald Reagan. I mean, they were acted out right along. I mean, Bush's dad, Clinton to a large extent, and then also, of course, George Bush, who put the last nail in the coffin of market capitalism, which it never is. It's never market. These guys, the capitalists mark the political state, the government more than all the rest of the 47% that you and Romney are so contemptuous of.
Hey, do you care about women and children?
Absolutely, and can I give you an example of how I'm compassionate?
No. Wait a minute. What about my question? I'm saying that when I said you don't know anything about economics, is Reaganomics is got us in this mess. We almost had a collapse of world capitalism thanks to the manipulation of the market by the forces that you support.
And you probably think that Ronald Reagan was one of the greatest presidents ever, don't you?
Oh, that. How did you know?
Because people like you are so amazingly predictable. Now, give me your example.
I want to hear what a compassion.
I'm dying to hear this one.
Go ahead, tell us our compassion.
Oh, here you're going to see how compassionate I am.
Oh.
Number one, I heard a recent story in the suburbs. You were talking about the issue of crime. There's a case I know for a fact's true in the suburbs where a 90-year-old man with no legs and he's deaf, he's been broken into by those predator creatures countless times. And what I would like to do is go over to his house and, number one, present him with a 00 buckshot case of ammo.
Compassion, big old gun.
And you could, maybe you could get to pull the trigger and just watch him bleed.
Because you would just be like, you would love that. I know it.
Any healthy community defends itself against predators. What we want to figure out is, why do we have a nation that's the wealthiest in the world and that has a crime rate of such proportions? And what it's all based on is that we have almost half the country is poor or near poor. And here, let me, in fact... I can pretty much
go down the line and tell you everything this guy thinks.
I've kind of had enough of you, Eric.
I've had it.
But here, Michigan logs 9 billionaires in the Forbes 400. They're worth a total of about $20 billion. So this, put this against the background of the Detroit police that are leaving because their working conditions are getting intolerable. 12-hour shifts.
That's just complete insanity.
9 billionaires in the Forbes list. Amway co-founder Richard DeVos, far right winger of Holland, the wealthiest Michigan resident, a mere $5.1 billion, and he's only 67th, followed by Hank and Doug, Meyer, you know, from Meyer's. They're actually kind of cool. They have union employees and what have you. Anyway, it goes down. Alfred Taubman and all these guys are up. He's gained $400 million over the last few years. The Stryker family that makes replacement joints and other medical devices. And so they're all up. Let me see. I should have got this a little more together here. But most of them, their wealth increased. So put this together. Here's nine guys that are worth $20 billion together. Most of them, they don't really do anything. They just own and,
rack it up.
And at the same time, you've got Detroit police officers, like I say, desperate to the point where they're passing out leaflets saying, don't come to Detroit because we can't guarantee your safety. Where these guys have enough money to solve the problem of the state just by writing a couple of checks.
So, this is never going to happen.
Yeah, no, of course not. So this is what, you have this massive redistribution of income that's going on all of the time, and it's all going out of our hands into their hands. I mean, that's
into the fat cats.
Yeah, that's about it. All right, let's take some more calls. And here's, here is Jerry. Jerry's in St. Clair Shores. Hi, Jerry, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter. Hey, Jolene.
Hi.
Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, I just want to begin by saying that I'm a UAW member myself. I'm a big supporter of unions, so this is no way anti-union at all. But there's no way I can bring myself to support a police union. For so long, the police have been the enforcement arm of the corporate industrial police complex that we see growing every day. I can count off countless examples. The Sterling Heights Detroit Free Press plant, when the union members went on strike, it was the police that were there to break up those picket lines and so forth.
I was there.
Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah.
The New York Police Department accepted I don't know how many millions of dollars into their retirement funds, while the people
from the
sat on balconies and taunted the protesters with champagne toast. And the police stood and enforced that. And now, when the police are getting theirs, they expect me to stand with them?
Not a chance.
One thing
that I have to say, though, we've said this all along, Peter, have we not?
What?
That these guys are doing what they're told to do.
Well, yeah, they're just following orders. I mean, here is the problem. I mean, obviously...
They need their jobs.
The state, the political state, is ultimately just armed men, right? I mean, that's all it is, because politicians can pass all the laws they want, and if they're not enforceable, if there's not somebody that can come out and say you're under arrest, if it's just, Aunt Maud down the street and say, hey, you just broke into somebody's house, I want you to come to court, you'd say, hey, get out of here, Aunt Maud. So there needs to be armed, people. There's also, you know, incredible, you know, the cops aren't always suppressing Occupy and union protests.
Right.
And,
that's not and always. Whatever.
They often seem to do it with great relish. I have been on any number of picket lines that have been attacked by the police. Union
yeah.
picket lines, anti-war picket lines, civil rights picket lines.
Right.
And the activities of the police, even in these Occupy suppressions over the last year, have been far from admirable. And, I mean, what's happening...
Lieutenant Pike, you know, yeah. set a bad example.
What's happening, too, is what they call the militarization of the urban police. So when they go out, as we were reading last, I was reading from an article last...
earlier in the show.
Yeah, no, last show.
Okay.
In San Jose, I mean, these guys came in tanks and full battle gear, you know, Kevlar armor, fully automatic weapons, and all of that. I mean, and that has that's absolutely impermissible. And watching, let me see, you're from St. Clair Shores. Well, I was out there with you, Jerry, and the UAW, and as the St. Clair Shores police and all the other police that were called in to break through those lines, you know, so it doesn't get, I don't have a real great memory of them either in that regard, in a political regard. And there are people within the labor movement, within the left, that say that the police should not even be in the union movement because usually, as you said, when it comes down to issues like labor issues, they're used by the owners to break the strikes, to, you know, to stop the, you know, well, break strikes, essentially. But, and that's one of their roles in society. So, I don't know how we cut it. On the other hand, on a day-to-day basis, we sure do count on them a lot. And I'm sure you, those same guys in St. Clair Shores, I'll bet you may even have known some of the St. Clair Shores police because I remember some of the UAW picketers and knew them and they were yelling at one another, by name. But ultimately, when it comes down to the day-to-day suppression of anything from speeding down your block to somebody breaking in, we're right now, that's who we're calling, right? The city police.
Well, you know, there's a couple points I can make here. You know, I had this same conversation with a police officer, and he said, well, you know, it's my job. You can't expect me to risk my job. But I'm like, wait a minute. You police always lecture people how you lay your lives on the line every day. But then you turn around and say you're not willing to risk your job for us? Well, if you're not willing to risk your job, why should I believe that you'd go so far as to risk your life? I mean,
you know what? I don't buy that. Let me tell you this. Here's a good example, Jerry. And you may remember there was during the great newspaper strike from 1995 to 2000, and a lot of these battles took place between the thousands of strikers and their supporters, including me and the St. Clair Shores police. It also and it included police from a lot of different departments. It also included Macomb County sheriffs. Now, the strikers had a strike paper, which all of a sudden it's out of my brain what it was called, but they took out ads. The Macomb County Sheriff's Union took out ads every single issue yeah. saying, we support your right to strike. So on one hand, they're being called upon by, you know, whoever runs Macomb County, the sheriff of Macomb County, saying you got to go out there and not let those strikers block the access to the plant, which was what we were doing. And that's, you know, I mean, come on, Jerry, that's strictly illegal. So the only time the police cease to protect property and the owners and the corporations is when there's a revolution.
Well, and what side will they be on then? You know, let's clearly understand that I do not believe the police are on the side of the people. No longer.
Okay. You know, actually, I got to go to a break. So let's leave it at that. I'd like to hear from some police officers, too.
Yes, please.
All right. We'll be right back and a lot more of this. Thanks for joining us and stick around.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Hey, Rick, you are going to Las Vegas.
All right. This is cool, man.
WRIF Sin City Takeover. Details online at WRIF.com.
Julie, you're listening. listening to Night Call, the Riff award-winning talk show on 101 WRAN.
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our second hour. You can get on the air, 313-298-WRIF. That's
313-298-9743.
We didn't even mention our Facebook. Always want more people interacting with us. Facebook.com/nightcall. I see some people are already beginning to list comments there. And at 1 a.m., I'm going to be interviewing Lawrence Berggreen. He's written, you know, this is not, I always got to apologize for this. I mean, he's written a book about Columbus. People go, well, I know about that dude, you know, 1492, sailed.
Yeah, yeah, there's a lot more.
There's a lot more, yeah. And also Marina Citrin, and she's written something called Occupying Language.
Okay.
You know, so, because how much language are we subjected to? One of the things that we've been subjected to, I've been seeing these ads on television, and as soon as they come on, I mute it. Or one of the things my wife and I do, we have a recorder. So yeah. we record a show. Say it's supposed to start at 10 o'clock.
Oh, you mean you skip through commercials?
We record it for 15 minutes. You know, we record it and then start it at 10:15, and okay. then we don't have to do it. So I'm seeing all this stuff about how, you know, your children's safety is at risk by changing Michigan's laws. And when it comes to our kids, shouldn't their safety come first? And then it says Proposition 2 risks our children's safety. And I'm going, wow, man, what is that about some pedophile thing? No, you know, these people are so evil. What that is, this is Proposition 2 is a proposal to amend the state constitution that would mean that collective bargaining could not be taken away from people that elect to do it.
And they're playing with people's heads with these.
So this has nothing to do with child safety or...
God, that's disgusting.
Yeah, it really is. It all has to do whether there's a continuing erosion of collective bargaining rights for people that are in unions. And now, I mean, the union members have come down to such a small percentage of the population.
Yeah.
I actually think the Party of Resentment, the largest party in the United States, and in Michigan, will probably vote it down. They say, oh, you know, I'm only making $7.80 an hour. Why should I support people that are making $22 an hour?
Yeah.
Well, here's what's happening. This is
By the way, if you're on hold, we're going to be right to you.
She's worried that everybody's going to hang up because I'm blabbing too much.
Well, I got to control some things around here sometimes.
Okay. This is from the Economic Policy Institute, a study they did that shows the erosion of collective bargaining was a major factor contributing to the failure of middle-class incomes in Michigan to grow between 1979 and 2007. Now, this isn't talking about union members. This is talking about the whole middle class, and this affects the classes below the middle class as well. Michigan's economy, like the U.S. economy as a whole, grew, but this growth did not translate into higher living standards for the typical worker in Michigan. This divergence between compensation and the growth of productivity in both Michigan and the United States as a whole was strongly related to the erosion of collective bargaining. In fact, over the past three decades, Michigan's middle-class workers did worse than middle-class U.S. workers in general because collective bargaining eroded more in Michigan than in the nation overall. I thought this was supposed to be a big union state. And then it gives all the percentages. Middle-class incomes in 1979 were 13% above the U.S. average. Now they're like 6% below. But let me see here. But the Michigan's top 5% grew by 60%.
My God.
And you know, folks, there's X amount of wealth, and the whole thing is how is it distributed? And the 1% and the political expression, of course, is Romney and Ryan, being financed by people like the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and the rest of these billionaires that want more money. I mean, how could these millionaires, these billionaires in Michigan that have billions and billions and billions of dollars as it is, and look around and see our cities, not just Detroit, but cities all around, and say, I just want to make more money.
Yeah.
88-year-old guy just increased his fortune by $400 million.
He's 88. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to use that because I'm going to, buy lots of Viagra for my, 28-year-old wife or something like that. So the corporations are all upset about this, the possibility of the Proposition 2 passing, which I would urge a strong yes vote on. Well, let's see. Finally, collective bargaining here. If you're not in a union, probably the majority of you listening are not. In fact, I know the majority of you listening are not. Collective bargaining also benefits workers who are not covered by collective bargaining agreements. In occupations and industries where collective bargaining is strong, employers will frequently meet standards set by agreements and improve their composition and labor practices. And the best example are the auto companies in the South, Tennessee and Alabama and places like that, Honda and
Saturn.
Kia, and Saturn was one of the first, because they said, well, wait a minute, we're going to give these people the same sort of compensation, but they won't join a union because they'll figure, well, wait a minute, we're getting the same amount of money.
Yeah.
Why should we also be in a union? So what it did, it raises union wages, raise all boats. And what's happening now? The concerted ruling class 1%, Romney, Ryan, Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson plan is to do two things. One is to lower everybody's wages, which means then there's going to be this massive redistribution of wealth, which goes to them.
Yeah.
Right? It's an investment. When these guys are putting tens of millions of dollars into these candidates, it's not because they want good government. It's because they want more effing money.
It's about themselves.
Yeah.
It's about their pocketbooks, period.
And it's purely...
And they're afraid of, like, they have this certain amount of money. They have to keep making it because they're afraid that that's going to go away. They want to keep it at that level. You know, when people get more money and more money, you just continue to want more.
I think it's just...
Bigger, better, faster, more.
I think it's just pathological.
Yeah, well, there's that, too.
Yeah. Alfred Taubman, 88, of Bloomfield Hills... has $2.9 billion in net worth, up $400 million over a year ago. I mean, $400 million, you know what that could do for the city of Detroit?
Yeah, a whole lot.
Yeah. Or these guys who total, the nine billionaires in Michigan, worth $20 billion, leave each of them with $200 million and have a wealth tax that confiscates all that and use it for the general welfare. General welfare. God, what a commie term. Oh, no. That's in, is that the beginning of the Constitution? It's the Constitution, right. Yeah. Provide for the general welfare. All right, let's get your calls. Hang on and we'll get them all. Be a little patient. Here's Tommy in Farmington Hills. Tommy, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing, Peter? How you doing, Jolene?
We're good.
Hey, hi,
thanks
Tommy.
For calling.
Yeah, the reason why I'm calling is because Romney, he seems to forget that there's actually poor people that live in the U.S.
Yeah, he's pretty unaware. Isn't
no, he talked about him, the 47%. He's aware
of
them.
Yeah, oh yeah. There's scum. Remember that?
Well, he didn't
the scourge.
Quite say that.
That's pretty much what he
meant.
Alluded to.
That's the way. Yeah, we should tell people. That's the way the rich talk about you folks. You know, some of you who are going to vote for Romney, and they think little of you. But go ahead.
Really
sorry.
Really quick,
Tom.
Breaking news: Chavez won the vote in Venezuela. Speaking of socialism,
Hugo Chavez reelected president of Venezuela.
Just came in, so go ahead.
Go ahead.
My roommate and I—we both live off Social Security.
Okay.
I don't make even $12,000 a year on Social Security. I am literally at the bottom of a barrel. Him and I both are.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Romney immediately wants to cut is Social Security.
Oh, yeah. He would love to.
Well, he doesn't want to cut it. May I ask how old you are?
I'm 24.
Oh, so you're on disability?
Yes, I'm on SSDI.
Okay. He now says, by the way, that he was wrong about talking about the 47%.
Oh, God.
He said he got caught, right?
He got caught. He meant it.
That's the way these rich people think, yeah. And, what should be happening? We ought to be thinking about ways that we can create a better living situation for you and your roommate.
It should be better than 12,000. And, you know, all these people talking about entitlements and people who live sucking off the teat of the government, things like that. Well, you're not living a very glamorous life, are you?
No, I'm not at all. I live in a trailer. I live in a one-bedroom trailer, and I have a roommate.
And you're barely getting by.
Exactly. We're struggling. At the end of the month, once I pay my bills, I have $20 left over to survive for a month.
I'm telling you. And so these people are absolutely, this just seems to be
they're
my
criminals.
Thing word. They're criminals and they're disgusting.
Yeah. I mean, they you know, how they live. I mean, they go to $50,000 a plate dinners to raise money for Romney. And they get, you know, these content, they're happy to hear these contemptuous remarks. Can you imagine a room filled with compassionate people. You remember that one guy, Eric, was talking about his compassion. He wanted to go over with a shotgun filled with 00 buckshot or something like that. Yeah. That's the level of their compassion. As opposed to if someone said something like that in a room full of rich Democrats, because there were $50,000 a plate dinners for Obama as well, and they raised a ton of money in September, I think $181 billion. Mm-hmm. But if if Obama would have said something like if Obama would have said something like Romney said, the whole room probably would have stood up and started shouting at him. But these folks, they just kept eating their foie gras, right?
Right.
That's what they want to hear.
And I want to say something that just came out also, other than the Chavez thing. Apparently, Obama.
Yeah.
Poked fun at himself at one of his fundraisers this weekend about his performance. And there were a bunch of Stevie Wonder performed, Katy Perry, John Bon Jovi, Earth, Wind & Fire, Jennifer Hudson. And he said, everybody here are incredible professionals, great friends, and they just perform flawlessly night after night. I can't always say the same. And I guess it drew a lot of laughter and cheers from the crowd. So.
All right, Tommy, the best to you, and I know it's hard, and we just got to make sure that these greed heads and their stooges have less power more than more. So
yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Appreciate it, and best to you.
Best.
Let's see. Here's Keith. Keith is in Dearborn Heights. Go ahead, Keith. You're on the air.
Yeah, just a couple comments. First, I guess the person earlier who said Obama is a socialist, I get kind of tired of that because if he is, he's probably one of the worst socialists ever because income inequality has increased under his term. Not necessarily his fault. I'm not saying he's a bad president, but he's certainly not a socialist. I mean, Wall Street's doing very well under Obama, and tax revenues are at an almost all-time low.
You're right.
A lot of things that the Republicans say they want are happening. Maybe not fast enough for him, but you know, it's such a silly argument because, like you said, he's pretty much a centrist Democrat,
right.
Sort of a not really a pro corporate politician, but certainly. He's not Bernie Sanders.
No, he is not. Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent, in fact, who says he's lists himself as a democratic socialist. No, most of Obama's policies are corporate policies because that's the nature of American capitalism. And he sees, just like, he did the bailout of the Detroit automakers, that it's a corporate policy. So that's going to essentially be what brings the economy back, if it, in fact, comes back.
Right.
Yeah.
And then the other comment, just with the, I don't consider myself a fan of the police in general, but I think I'm on their side with the collective bargaining thing, and I think it's important to note. I do door-to-door work for the unions, and not every police officer, especially not the Detroit police officers, they're not all reactionaries. I mean, some of them really get it. I mean, their politics are in the right place, and they know. And if we underpay police officers or make them work long shifts, we're probably not going to have the most professional people out there, and we'll have more problems with brutality and crummy officers. I think if we pay them like professionals and treat them like professionals and require them to have education and training and stuff, you know, we might have better people out there. It's kind of like teachers. If you pay teachers, you get decent teachers. If you don't pay them, the really good people might not go into teaching. And so I think it's the same thing with the cops. And I think lumping all police officers together is a mistake because I think, I think there are some excesses in every police force, but I think the Detroit police, in terms of the way they handled the Occupy movement, were somewhat restrained and
they were cool.
Oh, yeah, they were beyond restrained.
They were beyond restrained, and they would say to, like, someone said to you, you know, I'm on your side, man, or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, the police were going up to the Occupy people when they had the encampment in Grand Circus Park and saying, do you need anything? And they said, yeah, we need a few more barriers, and we're having trouble with this person. And they were very cooperative. On the other hand, you saw, police, we saw that, the excesses that occurred from the police in New York, and which you really have a bunch of extraordinarily vicious police among the New York cops, and same thing in Oakland as well. But also in the suburbs, in the suburb that, and I don't know, for a lot of reasons, people probably wonder, why don't I say my wife's name? Why don't I say what suburb that Jalene and I live in, who's not my wife? We always tell people that the police there, for instance, are headed by a guy who's in the Democratic Party activist. He actually said to me, he said, yeah, some of the knuckleheads in my force still vote Republican. But a lot of the police, at least in political terms, are beginning to get it, that they are as much under the gun of the Republicans to destroy their unions as much as to destroy all the unions. I mean, they in a lot of ways, they can't separate. They can't say, okay, we're going to destroy all the unions except for the ones that the police and fire fighters are in. And actually, we were mentioning earlier the great Detroit newspaper strike from 1995 to 2000 that the strikers, and if any of you are listening now, can correct me if I'm wrong, gave our suburbs police the highest marks in terms of how they operated. But, yeah. Okay, Keith, thank you very much.
Thanks, Keith.
Appreciate your call here. And there's an open line, 313-298-WRIF. Here's Mike in Brighton. Mike, hi. You're on the air. Welcome. Mike, are
Hello?
You? Yeah, Mike, hi. You're on the
air.
Yeah,
yeah. How are you guys doing tonight?
We're doing good. Great. What's up with you? How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'm alive.
Well, that's
great. Yeah, I was calling mainly for the whole the thing about Romney, about how he doesn't realize that there's poor people in the United States, kind of like how this thing. Well, the guy I was talking to, he was 24, and he's living in a trailer, and they're off Social Security. Well, I've been looking for a job for the past 3 or 4 months. I'm living in my car. Like,
oh, boy.
They won't give me a food card or anything like that. And so I'm just trying to get my voice out there to let Romney know that I exist.
Well, what do you think what do you think about this? I don't know. You know, people fastened on the statement of Romney when he was talking to his rich buddies and didn't realize he was being taped. He said that they believe they are victims who are entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. And that's usually what people have been fascinating on. But what struck me, he said, we can't get these people to take responsibility for their lives. So he's talking about you. I mean, although
I was actually kind of appalled when I heard that, because I tried very hard in the past. I've worked on and off, and when I work very hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't ever try to point a finger and blame somebody else for my problems. But some people just aren't as lucky as, say, Romney, who's probably grew up in a rich family.
Well, he did.
He did. He went to Cranbrook.
Had top education, where somebody like me has to work extremely, extremely hard just to be able, for the opportunity to be able to study and further themselves. And furthermore, I mean, I could make a computer that's, you know, you'd get the same quality at Dell for $5,000. And I can make it for $600 for you right now, but the reason I can't do that as a professional is because I don't have a piece of paper that I don't have, you know, $80,000 to buy, basically.
Sure. Well, that's it. I mean, guys like Romney, you know, were born on third base. Well, actually, they were born on home plate and think they hit a, you know, home run. And, you know, I was just listening to a talk show host, Mike Papantonio. Do you ever hear him?
Yeah, he's good.
And it was odd. He was bringing up this incident that when Romney was going to Cranbrook, which is this elite prep school out in, Bloomfield Hills, where Romney and his rich buddies found this kid with long hair back in the 60s, I guess it was, you know, when people were
wearing.
True story. And they held him down and shaved his head. Now, the same thing had happened to this Mike Papantonio, and he said, and he said he had never forgotten it, and that he mentioned that every single person that was involved in that assault, I mean, that Romney was part of, talk about the police, that's an illegal assault on somebody. Somebody, you know, a gang grabs you and shoots. This is what fascists do, by the way. This was,
He started early.
Yeah. And, every one of those guys that was in the little gang of Romney remembered that and said they were shamefaced. And Romney said, He didn't remember it.
Of course not. Yeah. It's a miracle how they forget these things.
Mike, best of luck to you. I mean, an empty phrase to have to say. I mean,
I hope something happens for you.
Right. Okay.
And maybe go back and try to get a food card again. They've got to give you something.
I guess. Yeah. And, you know, the whole thing, though, that we have to wish people luck, because if you have 500 people looking for a job,
and there's five jobs,
it is a matter of luck, or, you know, because, yeah, what does he say? They think they're entitled to health care, to food, to housing, to you name it. Yeah, you know what? We all are entitled to that. And we shouldn't live in an economic system where we have people making billion, 88-year-olds adding $400 million to their personal fortune, where Mike has to live in his car.
Mitt Romney is heartless.
Well, no. Ann Romney said they showed what a warm, compassionate human being he is.
Well, yeah. I'm going to listen to her.
Yeah. All right, here is Robert in Ypsilanti. Some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Hey, Robert, you're on the air. Welcome.
You got to click on it, Peter.
I thought I did. Sorry. Click it. Here, Robert, you're on the air. Go ahead.
All right, how you doing?
We're good.
Hi, Robert.
That's good. The police officers there should tell the people that are running the place, like the governor and all that stuff, maybe they should take a pay cut.
The governor?
Yeah, the governor, mayor, everybody else that runs the place, that is in charge.
You know,
in charge of the whole United States and all that, everybody that's in charge, they've been telling us since 79 to take a pay cut.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right, well, let them take a pay cut.
Yeah, like, let's do it.
You know, Robert,
I like it.
They should have been doing that from a long time ago.
I think, you know, the CEO pay and all that is absolutely out of control for sure. I think, though, that Governor Snyder may not be taking a salary or taking $1.
Well, yeah, because he's a multimillionaire, right?
Well, he doesn't need it. Well, none of these guys need it.
Then why are they even in politics? They're the ones screwing everything up.
Well, he says he's going to fix everything, although
they've been saying that for years.
Yeah, Michigan unemployment is actually
and their trickle-down economics means trickle, fix everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, put people back to work.
Well,
let them take their pay cuts. You know, how many people can you put to work on $1 billion?
Well, probably a lot. And I mean, what you really need, in my estimation, they're talking about doing this in England, is a wealth tax, not just a tax on income. I mean, you need a tremendously higher taxes on the ultra-wealthy, on the 1%, for sure. I mean, that's one of the things that sunk us was Bush's tax cuts for the ultra-wealthy. I mean, they are the ones that benefited from it. Then he starts two wars. They're not funded. Then he starts a drug plan. That's not funded.
That little thing.
Yeah. But what you really need is some confiscatory taxes. And that is, you know, maybe when someone, you know, gets over $1 billion, it goes into the general fund, because that's where it came from. It came from all of us. You know, wealth does not appear from nowhere. And Alfred Taubman, at 88 years old, he didn't make $400 million. How did he make it? You know, I mean, just his investments grew.
Yeah.
I mean, and in the meantime, real people are hurting. And if we lived in a society where people didn't, I mean, this is insane. This is not like socialism or communism. Talk about people, the most they could make was $1 billion. And people say, you take away all of their initiative. Yeah, I wouldn't get out of bed for $1 billion, would you? I mean, how about even $100 million? I mean, what if he even, you know, stopped income at $1 million until, you know, there was a book a long time ago said, everything I learned in kindergarten.
Yeah.
And it was what? You don't bring candy unless you can share it with everyone?
Yeah.
Yeah. So as long as we have Mike living in his car and Tommy, you know, living on $12,000 a year and disabled, as long as you have that, isn't there something just obscene about somebody adding $400 million to their already billions?
And was it 1 year?
Yeah, 1 year.
1 year.
1 year. Huh. Yeah, yeah.
And how are you doing out there?
And what service did Al Taubman provide? I mean, come on. All right. Let's get some more calls going here. Here's Patrick. Patrick is in Flint. Hi, Patrick. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, how are you doing there?
Good.
This is a response to Mike. About, you know, not being able to get any assistance and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he can get it. He's going to have to try really hard and go through all means, because I'm a 45-year-old male, spent 7 years incarcerated, got out, and was bound and determined not to go back.
Yeah.
And I got me a great job. Been good for 20-some years now.
Awesome.
No troubles or anything. But for a person like him who is not being able to work as much and getting any help, he's got to stay persistent about that because there are programs out there that will help people out.
See, that's what I'm saying.
There
Keep
are.
Trying.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that you called to reiterate that.
Yeah.
You know, you can't give up. I've seen so many people say, well, there's not jobs out there. Bull crap.
Well,
because
no.
Before
Wait a minute.
The,
Benji, Wait a minute.
The jobs
minute.
Aren't there.
I thought you were on the same train
no,
as
no,
me.
No, he is.
I was talking about going back to the... whatever, or Social Security,
yeah.
And saying, you know, I'm starving.
There's sort of an idea.
Okay, I take it back.
There's sort,
not on the same
way, there's sort of an idea that if everybody tried hard enough, they could find work. I mean, there's not enough jobs
not
for
true.
The people that are out of work.
It's not statistically
right.
possible.
Yeah.
There's not enough jobs, but there are plenty of jobs, even if you have to work at Burger King for
no.
a few months.
Well,
those
that's what's
happening. Those are taken.
Yeah, those are mostly taken, but that's what's happening, and that's what the shame of it is, Patrick, is that people that once made good union wages are now working for Burger King. You know, even during the Depression, people used to say, anybody that wants to get a job, if they try hard enough, they can find one. And there were story after story, even when you had 30% unemployment, of people just, you know, doing everything they could and finally landing a job. And the sort of anecdotal, you know, these stories would bolster the fact that you could get a job if, quote, you really tried. And what that does, it really reinforces the myth that somehow that the fault lies with the people that aren't working.
And I want to tell you, I know firsthand that that's not true. I mean, just because, first of all, it's not true. But second of all, I had a roommate for a couple of years who tried exhaustively to find work, was everywhere, anything, could not get hired. There was nothing.
All right, thank you, Patrick. Appreciate it. But you got to go get those services. This is what we deserve as residents of the state of Michigan or wherever.
That's you're right.
Listening. You know, and also I remember I was on a panel, on a music panel,
mm-hmm.
put on by a Michigan music magazine. It doesn't even exist anymore. Called Jamrag. Remember
I
that?
I remember.
Yeah. I mean, good little magazine. And so there were all these Detroit area musicians came, and man, there's, you know, that's the greatest music around here.
I
used to host not the Riff Rock Cafe.
The local show.
Motor City Riffs.
Yes, you did.
Motor City Riffs. I used to host that before Doug Podell did. And so,
they've been around a long time.
They invited me to talk, and another DJ who I won't even say who it is, but the person, I won't even say the gender,
okay.
You know where I'm going, said to these people, every one of you can become a success, and started saying, you know, you've got the talent, you've got the equipment, you've got
I
the voice,
this.
Every single one of you can become a success. So I get up there and I say, well, this is a little different. First thing I would say is keep your day job.
Yeah. Where were you speaking?
I can't even remember where
it was.
It
was like at school.
Like
probably.
Maybe it was like even Wayne State or something like that. But anyway, so what I was saying was that, that many, what are they, something, many come but few are called or something like that. And everybody can't be a musical success. And in a down economy where jobs are fleeing, manufacturing jobs, because of, the Romney types of the world that want to go pay people $3 an hour rather than $25 or $30 an hour because they want to make more money because they want to add $400 million to their billions already and then keep their money in the Cayman Islands.
Yeah, and not
report
your income taxes.
Yeah, what about his income tax? By the way, I don't see this just facing me right now, but they estimate that the wealthy of the world have $1.7 trillion sequestered away from tax shelters.
My gosh.
Including the Romney types of the world.
Almost $2 trillion.
Yeah. And that, by the way, is enough probably to...
And if we don't pay our taxes, we're in big trouble.
$1.7 trillion could probably eliminate poverty in the world.
Yes.
Yeah. Here's Will and Adrian. Will, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how you doing tonight?
Good. We're good.
Listen, I don't even know that I have a specific topic to talk about. So kind of what I'd like to do, if you'll give me a little bit of leeway, is this. I really got into your show back around 91, 92 when I got out of the military. And you kind of introduced me to It's funny you mentioned Jamrag, but it also you introduced me to Metro Times and Noam Chomsky and a lot of stuff. And it's really been over the last, I want to tell you, 5-6 months that I've gotten reconnected. I got a divorce, I'm working a part-time job, and I got to be really honest with you. I look at the format and look at what you're doing, and there's a whole ton more bitterness coming out that I just kind of think, wow, what happened to this cat who at one time had all these great ideals and
he's still got
where
him.
We could go.
Why do you think
he's
I don't have any ideals?
He's the same person.
No. I think you do have ideals, but here's the thing, Pete. At one point, and I should probably tell you this, I'm actually a social worker, and I don't think either the Democrat Party or the Republican Party has the answer. And I hear you guys slamming Republicans.
We slam Democrats, too.
Well, we don't slam them. Here's what I'm going to do. I was thinking about putting on my website suggested who to vote for. And I was going to say, President, don't vote for Romney. So if you want to, I mean, Obama's got the state locked. So, you know, if you want to vote for the Greens on the left, or I don't know who these parties are on the right, or the Natural Law Party. That's not on the right, by the way. Okay, but I wasn't even going to endorse Obama. I think we have to make sure that Romney and Ryan do not wind up to be the president and vice president.
Yeah.
Number one task.
And you know what? I understand what you're saying, and I get it, but here's the problem. And I'm being real sincere when I say this. The hatefulness that comes out
of,
you know, of you guys, here's the thing.
Of us. Have you listened to the Republicans lately? I mean,
have you watched Fox News lately? Hey, you know what? We are PO'd. Who isn't? And if you're not angry about what's going on out there, I feel like you're not paying attention.
I get it, but here's the problem. You're using that as an excuse to say, let's be just as bitter and angry.
Oh,
are not anywhere near as bitter and angry.
Yeah, and
we are righteously angry.
Yeah, and you're social working me. All right, Will, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I thought he was going to interview us.
Why are you so angry?
How does that make you feel?
Yeah, right.
Pissed!
Yeah. Were you angry at your father when he told you what to do?
And I want to tell you as a woman, what's going on, the assault, this war on women, as they say it, and I'm going to go right with it. If I weren't mad about that, there's a problem there. We're just highly engaged political people. We're paying attention. And if you are, then you're going to have a little anger.
I can't believe that I have actually changed either. I'll tell you, the right wing has gotten so crazy.
I think you're more fed up than ever.
Well, I am. Because
you have a right to be.
Because these conservatives, you know, back in the day, you could have a conversation with it. Now they're almost nuts. I mean, the leadership particularly. I mean, we know conservatives that work here, and they
get up in our craw a little bit.
Yeah, but, you know, they're good people.
They've been our friends for many, many years.
But these politicians that the Republican Party's put forth, these billionaires that are behind the Tea Party and the Republican Party, they're a pack of psychopaths.
They've amped it up to levels unknown to mankind.
Well, now known. Just a couple of them. Here, Representative Paul Brown of Georgia says, God's word is true. He said in a video posted on a church website, I've come to understand, this is a United States congressman, all the stuff I was taught about evolution and embryology and the Big Bang Theory.
Embryology?
You know, yeah, and the Big Bang Theory, you know, how the universe began.
Yeah.
All that is lies straight from the pit of hell. It's lies to keep me and all the folks who are taught that from understanding they need a savior. This is a congressman who believes the earth is about 9,000 years old and was made in 6 days.
Okay.
An Arkansas Republican candidate, says slavery was a blessing in disguise for black people. He wrote in his book, the institution of slavery that the black race has long believed to be an abomination upon its people may actually have been a blessing in disguise.
Okay, what was that listener's name that we just talked to? Do you remember?
Paul? No, I don't know.
I just want to say, doesn't that make you angry?
And he said they would have been much worse off than they had been if they had not been captured and shipped to the United States. This is the Republican Party today, folks. And then there's another guy in Arkansas, Charlie Fuqua of Batesville. He's running for the, he served in the Arkansas House. He's running for Congress now. He said there's no solution to the Muslim problem short of expelling all followers of the religion from the United States.
Oh, my gosh.
I think, why not put them in concentration camps? There's a good idea.
God, I mean, really, he would be happy if that happened. He would be thrilled.
Here, a Florida Republican operative telling senior citizens in Florida, in Florida, Obama is a Muslim who's going to get rid of your Medicare. I mean, this is
okay,
the Republican Party today.
On this, about this story, and we're going to get right to your phone calls after this. This was a volunteer, not an operative. It was a volunteer for the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right, Peter.
All right, we got all of you waiting to talk. We'll do it right after these.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Thanks for rocking with the Riff online. This is WRIF.com.
Do you need cash right now for any reason? Then you need Matt's Jewelry Brokers. At Matt's, they pay top dollar for your used or broken gold, silver, and platinum jewelry, class rings, belt buckles, coins, flatware, and more. It's really that easy. Stop into one of Matt's 5 locations with your items and walk out with cold, hard cash.
Hi, I'm Matt. We've been family-owned and operated for 30 years and pride ourselves on honesty, integrity, and paying more than the superstores do for your broken or used items just lying around the house. If it's collecting dust, we'll buy it. If it's broken, we'll buy it. If you don't want it, we'll buy it. So before you go anywhere else, stop by one of my 5 locations. In Macomb at 21 Mile and Romeo Plank, in Troy at Square Lake and Rochester Road, or my pawn shop in Southfield at 10 Mile and Greenfield. We're also in the Meyer in Clinton Township and Lenox. Check us out online at MattsJewelryBrokers.com or call us at 586-286-2866. That's 586-286-2866. When you need cash fast, go to Matt's.
Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com.
You think you're special. I can see it in your eyes. I can see it in you. will straight up leave your sh- and you'll be the one who's left missing me.
That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Julie.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. This is our final segment, so grab those lines if you want to make a comment. Jolene just announced a little earlier that Hugo Chavez of Venezuela has won re-election. I was just looking at my favorite, and I put that in quotes, right-wing news site, and they had in quotes, Hugo wins in quotes. And so I thought, gee, maybe.
And they,
and they had his photo upside down. Yeah. Eat your heart out, fascists. But it's, but, and so then it links, it just links to the Associated Press. Venezuela's Electoral Council says President Hugo Chavez has won re-election, defeating challenger Enrique Capriles. National Bible said that Chavez had about 54% of the vote. It's his third re-election victory in nearly 14 years. It gives Chavez another six-year term to cement his legacy and press more forcefully the transition to socialism in the country with the world's largest proven oil reserves. So, there you go. I was in Venezuela when...
Of which some of the money goes to the poor.
And oh, yeah,
which,
yeah.
And of which some of the profits from the oil profits have in the past. I'm not sure if he's still doing that. Gone to, like, the Bronx. He's
oh, yeah.
provided heating
through
oil.
Citgo.
Through Citgo. He's, yeah, because... That's Venezuelan oil. He's provided poor people in the United States with heating oil. And when our own government doesn't do that.
Yeah. Now, by the way, talk about the redistribution of income. When we pay more at the gas pump, that's redistribution of income. More of our money is going to the people that own the oil companies. And it's not, they say, well, you know, the price at the barrel head has gone up. Well, why do they always wind up making that much more? And why is gasoline in California like $5.75
oh, yeah.
a gallon
yeah.
Right now? The money, when you should, and that's why Jolene and I only fill up at Citgo. That
yep.
money, whatever you think of Hugo Chavez, and I've got a lot of criticisms.
Better than
of
Middle Eastern oil.
Yeah. I've got a lot of criticisms of Hugo Chavez. Again, the criticisms from the left.
Well, yeah, from the left. And you've been to Venezuela twice. You've seen what's going on there. Oh, once. I thought it was twice.
No, no. And I was there. I was actually not in an anti-Chavez demonstration, but in a demonstration against Chavez policies.
Mm-hmm.
And that was they want to expand the industrial footprint of the oil industry and the shipping industry. So mm-hmm. that means they're going to be destroying all this environmentally sensitive
right.
land.
Sound familiar?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what industrialism is all about. The, you know, it destroys more and more the natural world, our planetary heritage and all that.
Our planet so, is choking.
And these were, you know, native people from these different tribes.
Yeah,
and it was
yeah.
So spirited. And there was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. So we...
I bet it was beautiful.
We marched with them.
We
yeah.
do have full lines on the phone.
So you want me to get to
yes,
them.
I do.
Okay. I want to talk and talk
we
and talk.
We have 15. I know you do.
All right.
We have 15 minutes left of the show.
All right,
so
we'll do it. Well, okay. Here's Joe and Taylor. Joe, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Pierre. Hey, Julian. How are you?
Hi, Joe. Great.
I just want to call you out on a couple of things.
Sure.
kind of bear with me on a few things here. The consistency on you guys. I don't hear both sides of the story. You guys sit there and say that, you know, Romney had, he gets all these, you know, I'm sorry, I'm kind of...
Oh, wait.
Okay. No, don't say it. Don't say the N-word. And then this is nervous. This is nervous.
Hold on. All right.
His tax, like where he hides his money?
No. Okay, say for instance, you were talking earlier about how he spends money or whatnot. You guys don't say, Pete.
What are you trying to say? We don't say that Obama himself is supported by people who at $50,000 a plate dinner. I just did say that through the sales of his book that actually Obama has become a millionaire. He's not a multimillionaire. And here's what it's all about, Joe, is that Mike lives in his car. Romney has a house.
That has its own elevator.
Yeah, so it's like that. And
that pretty much says it all.
It does. All right, Joe. Thank you very much. And we're going to go through these kind of quickly because
I understand getting nervous. Feel bad.
And here is Yaya in Dearborn Heights. Yaya, hi. You're on the air. We're going to get your Yayas out.
Guys, how are you?
Hi,
okay,
Yaya.
I was one. A lot of people. Obviously, I got family in Venezuela. All of them are crying. Two good things that Chavez did. He called out Bush a couple years ago at the UN. I don't know if you remember that.
I do.
We do remember.
He said it. He said it smelled like sulfur because Bush had been there. The devil.
You look like a donkey. You smell like a sulfur. You're the devil.
Yeah.
Another thing. Yeah, the Citgo. But the one bad thing, or one of the many bad things that he's doing to my Venezuela, you know, country, is that he made everybody's financial information public.
Right.
So people that are looking at your bank account, they have easy access of your bank account. And the easy business over there, you know, one of the biggest jobs over there is getting kidnapped. You're going to get kidnapped. I know how much money you guys in your bank account. I'm going to ask your family for that amount of money.
Yeah.
By 7 o'clock, I remember in 1991, before I came to the States, 7 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock at night, midnight, you'll be walking on the streets, really, you know, it was safe. Everything was safe.
Yeah.
Right now, 7 o'clock at night, if you're not home, guess what? You're either kidnapped or you're dead.
Yeah, there's something, and I don't know why they can't get a handle on crime. When we were there in 2006... Two people.
Poverty.
Yeah, well, why is there poverty? I mean, when there's so much oil revenue. I don't know if it is. I don't know what's causing it. I've tried to, you know, read about it. But, yeah, two people in our group. One guy had his pocket picked. Another guy actually was, you know, knocked down by a couple people. And they just told us, you know, either go out in groups or don't go out. I mean, gasoline there is cheaper than water, literally. A gallon of water costs more than a gallon of gas. It's like 18 cents or something for gasoline. But yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
I didn't realize you were from Venezuela.
That's what, you know, that Chavez has got to face that and got to do something with that crime. I was, something else. I was just trying to think. I don't know. Let's move on.
Yeah.
The pollution in Caracas is like, you know, it's like New York. It's worse than New York because it's in a valley.
New York's bad.
And they've got, you know, all these cars without pollution controls and all that.
It's dirty.
Yeah. It is. Let's see. Here is Mike in Jackson. Mike, hi, you're on the air. Oops, sorry. Mike, hi.
President Obama has not passed a budget in 2 or 3 years. How does the government operate, and how does all these deficits affect us and future generations? And I understand there's something from September to September, but how do we pay the bills if a budget isn't being passed and enacted?
Well, they got to do that. I mean,
there's a whole thing about called Congress.
Yeah,
and the Republicans.
I mean, it's pretty hard to get through. The other thing is we're still throwing $1 trillion a year down the rat hole of military spending, where we could probably use about a third of that, but neither party. So, well, I mean, the Republicans, they want to increase military spending more than the Pentagon wants it, even. And because, you know, all their buddies are these contractors.
Because they need to do that, right?
And, you know, Obama certainly isn't going to cut the military budget. But there's enough money in this country that if it was adequately distributed, that about 90% of our problems, including the debt and the deficit, would probably go away. But I agree with you. They, you know, all of that has to be a handle gotten on that. and neither party is willing to do it. I mean, it's all, what, a game of face-off, and not good. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Here is Dave in Livonia. How are you doing?
Oh, thanks for taking my call, guys. Sure. I really love the show.
Thank you, Dave.
I know you guys are running short on time, so I'm going to try to keep it brief. There's two points I want to make about Proposal 2 that don't sit well with me.
All right, let me just tell people, though, that that would put into the Michigan Constitution the right for collective bargaining, so like in they couldn't do to unions what they did in Wisconsin. But go ahead.
Yes, okay, so my wife's in the union. I'm not, but I'm pro-union. But I've been doing some studying on this, on Proposal 2, just because I saw those commercials that were so misleading and kind of confusing.
They're cryptic.
Yeah, about child molestation. Yeah.
But there's two points with Proposal 2 in the fine print that I did some studying on that don't really sit well with me. And that's the fact that the Freedom of Information Act and open meeting laws can be superseded by collective bargaining agreements that are saying information in the agreements must be kept private. And second, the fact that anything bargained for and won in a government union collective bargaining agreements could supersede laws passed by elected officials.
No. Here, I mean, I'm looking at it right now, and one of them says laws may be enacted to prohibit public employees from striking. In other words, you could not bargain that away. Laws may be enacted to prohibit public employees from striking. So they're not giving that away. And I don't know what you're talking about with the thing about the Freedom of Information Act or open meetings.
Oh, it's in there. It's in there. I read it.
Well, wait a minute. It says grant public and private employees the constitutional right to organize and bargain collectively through labor unions. Invalidate existing or future state or local laws that limit the ability to join unions and bargain collectively and to negotiate and enforce collective bargaining agreements, including employees' financial support of their labor unions. Override state laws that regulate hours and conditions of employment to the extent that those laws conflict with collective bargaining agreements, and then it defines employers. There's nothing in it about what you're saying, and I got to get these other ones. I mean, if you're in a union, I mean, look at this is look who's for it and look who's against it. All the wealthy corporations that want to destroy the middle class standard of living want to defeat this. And they want your wife working for the minimum wage.
Yeah, they want to pay her less. They want to take away a lot of her benefits. And...
Yeah. Here is Paul in Sterling Heights. Paul, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jolene. Thanks.
Hi, Paul.
Paul. My issue basically is with the representation of what anger looks like.
Okay. Okay. All right.
I believe that there's a distinction between human dignity and privileged, let's call it arrogance.
Sure.
It's that 47% statement by Romney.
Right.
And personally... I host with another retired UAW auto worker a discussion group online, and my discussion group has been going great this year. I mean, we had 525 members the day before last Christmas. We now have 999 members.
Wow, that's terrific.
Okay, now here's the thing. I refuse to give away my anger. I refuse to tell you that you are responsible for my anger. Mm-hmm. I'm just selfish. Okay?
I'm just, I think that's pretty smart.
I'm not to blame anybody else for my anger.
Yeah.
Okay? The thing is that my buddy and I started this group.
Within your group?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know what? Hey, Paul, we're kind of running out of time, but I want to ask you something real quickly. Do you ever meet in together as a group in public?
Not just online.
Well, it's in an international server, so I've got members around the world.
All right, that's very cool, and I think that's wonderful. But and excuse me for being...
We have about 4 minutes left in
okay,
the show.
Okay, for being presumptuous. But even if you could get together in person with five guys, or guys and women around, somewhere in Sterling Heights and meet, because ultimately, all this online stuff is good because there's an exchange of ideas. People realize sometimes
easy
they're
access,
not alone. Easy access. But ultimately, it's going to be face-to-face stuff and the building of face-to-face communities that really resist what's trying to be forced on us. All right, I got to move along and get some of these final calls. Thank you very much.
Yes.
And great to hear about that.
Congrats.
And if Paul, send me a link to it, too. I'd like to see it.
calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
Yeah. Here's Chuck. Chuck, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I want to show Mandy Maroon how this is done. We don't got a lot of money, but we'd like to give that Mike guy that's living in his car $100, and we could help him a little more when we get paid on Friday. We could start out doing that.
Well, that is so sweet, but I have no idea how to get a hold of
him. Here's my thought on this, is you email us your information.
Right.
Mike, if you're still listening, call the show back. Like, call the same number you called before, or if you have access to email, it's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. If we could make something like that happen, hey, that's a beautiful thing, and you're a great man.
Yes, and let me just say quickly, Chuck.
You can give your information to our phone screen. Put back on hold.
All right, Chuck, here, lay out. Let me put you back on hold, and you can give your information to our phone screen.
Thank you so much. See, there are good people out there.
Yeah.
He has to wait to get paid. So he can help this guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that.
And get this.
And if I could, I would help anyone.
Yeah, and old Al Taubman, who made an extra $400 million this year, he could buy Mike a hotel.
He could.
But he's not.
And give him a job.
Yeah. Here is Del. Del's in White Lake. Del, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are you all doing?
We're good.
I was just listening to you all talking on here, and then you're talking about taxes and everything. I'm a retired UAW worker, and this year, the governor of Michigan, Schneider, he's taxed my pension now.
I know. Isn't that terrible? I mean, what the hell?
I didn't know if you all knew about all that.
Oh, yeah.
We knew.
I mean,
absolutely.
He's bragging about balancing the budget. Well, he's done things like tax pensions and also giving less revenue sharing to the cities, creating the kind of crises that we see in Detroit. And,
let me guess,
and
you
the
worked
suburb.
Really hard for that pension, didn't you?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
See? That's a crime. Crime.
See, I was pretty fortunate. I got in there when I was a youngster, and I was able to put 30 and a half years in the place. I didn't realize until I got about 20 years in there that, hey, this is going to be a good job here,
Yeah,
sure.
And your future's secure.
Yes, ma'am. And, things all went good. And, and then when I retired, I had 5-6 years of no work on retirement. And they started taxing my pension. I said, man, I got to find me some little extra work here now.
Yeah. So it hurt you to the point where you had to get another job.
To the point also then when someone in that position.
That makes me mad.
Also, when Dallas should just be enjoying,
his
pension years, his retirement, and he's going to take another job, which fills, takes another
his
spot.
Time, yeah.
All right, Dell, we're on it.
The guy who said we're angry, if that doesn't make you mad, what is wrong with you? Where's your pulse, dude?
Dell, thank you. Hey, listen, we have Mike and Chuck on the line, but
Well, they'll work it out in the
other
room.
Yeah, you guys, you work it out with Mike and Chuck on how you can hook one another.
And also want to thank, John and Calvin for taking the phone calls tonight, doing a great job, and they're going to work it out between Mike and Chuck.
Yeah,
they're
indeed.
Good people in the world.
All right, and coming right up, an interview with Lawrence Berggren, Columbus, the four voyages, and like I say, this is a little more than just Columbus sailed the blue. It's a pretty interesting interview. Also, after that, Marina Citrin, Occupying Language. Check this out.
So, cool.
Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan.
Next
week.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this. Detroit's Rock Station on the web. Thanks for listening to WRIF.com. Get all of Drew and Mike's best moments delivered right to your computer or mobile device. The Drew and Mike Podcast, brought to you by Matt's Jewelry Brokers. For fast cash, call Matt's at 586-286-2866. Subscribe today at WRIF.com. Everything that rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com.
Are you ready to pack your bags and go to Vegas?
Oh, my God! What a
town! WRIF Sin City Takeover. Details online at WRIF.com.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, everyone knows the story of Columbus, right? It was sometime in October coming up. Well, we'll get the day off. Anyway, he sailed from Spain. He, had the Queen of Spain, we think, pawn some jewelry, something like this. And then he was off to India or China and then discovered the U.S. So we all know the story, right? End of story. Well, of course not. There's so much more. And a book has come my way. In fact, it's come a lot of people's way because it's a New York Times bestseller. It's called Columbus, The Four Voyages. The Four Voyages, now we're talking, folks. 1492 to 1504. Lawrence Berggren is the author, and he's written lots of biographies before, other books as well. He's written a biography of Irving Berlin, of Al Capone, Louis Armstrong, of Marco Polo, of Magellan. So we are now looking, though, at this book, the latest, Columbus, The Four Voyages, in a paperback edition. It's a beautiful little edition. It's got maps in it and gives us an idea probably of Columbus that many of us don't know. It's a pleasure to welcome Lawrence Berggren. Lawrence, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you very much. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, one could say, well, wait a minute. Everybody knows this story. Why, you know, a 400-page book on it? What do you got that everybody doesn't know that little thumbnail I gave, which is, of course, an incredibly leading question?
Well, it's a great adventure story, and instead of just writing about the first voyage, which is the one we hear about in school, and which was pretty straightforward, he did go with his three ships and discovered the new world, although he thought he was in China. He went back three more times, and then the story gets more interesting, because over the next decade, each time he still kept thinking he was in China, and he deals with the consequences of what he had set in motion, the historical and personal forces, and he gets off on a wild magic carpet ride. Columbus was a visionary. He was a very volatile, unstable person who thought he could hear the voice of God, highly controversial in his own lifetime, as he is today. You'd mentioned getting the day off about Columbus, but that only started in 1937. There was no national holiday, a federal holiday in his honor until that time, although there had been some parades. And he actually didn't have much to do with North America, oddly enough. He had never set foot in North America. He never even knew it existed. If you had asked him where he thought he went on these four voyages that were sponsored by Ferdinand and Isabella, he would say, I went to part of China. His conception of the world was so faulty and so flawed, although in keeping with what people thought at that time, that it was remarkable. What was interesting was that Columbus, despite his visionary side, was in some ways a medieval person, a person of very fixed habits, who actually didn't learn that much from experience. And even when sailors and navigators around him thought that he should change his idea of the shape of the world based on his voyages, he wouldn't change it at all. I think a case in point was when they were exploring Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
The sailors heard from the, quote, Indians, the Taino people who lived on the island of Cuba, that it was, in fact, an island. And Columbus decided, oh, no, this must be a promontory of Asia, because that would conform to his theory. if it didn't, then he had to change the theory. He would have to change the whole bill of goods that he sold to Ferdinand and Isabella and the premise of the whole voyage. So, you know, his sailors and navigators said, well, this is very simple to prove. Let's just see if we can circumnavigate Cuba. And if we can, well, then, by gum, it's an island. He refused to do it. He said, oh, no, we don't have time. I know it's not an island. It's a promontory. And so they sailed on. So any facts that didn't fit his thesis, he discarded. He overlooked. And, you know, he was, as I said, given to all these irrational fits. And yet this is why we remember him. If he had been a normal, sane, responsible, sensible person with good judgment, we probably wouldn't have remembered him. Why do I say that? Well, that's what his brother was like. He had a brother named Bartholomew, who was known as the leader. He was considered as good a sailor as Columbus, or better. And he sailed with Columbus on some of these voyages. And yet, we barely know anything about him. He helped get his brother out of several jams. He was the one who was centered or grounded, who reasoned with Columbus. But he wasn't a visionary. He was merely responsible and competent. It was Columbus who was, in some ways, kind of moonstruck, who was the memorable figure. Now, there was kind of a tragic side to this, because, as you know, as we all know, he set in motion historical forces that were very tragic. For example, he brought germs with him. There was a transfer of not only ideas and culture, but animal, vegetable, material when he came to the New World, which he thought was China. And he brought back life forms, animal and vegetable, to Europe, such as tomatoes, along with many other things that had never been seen there before. And that's right, there was no tomato sauce before Columbus, no pineapples, and on and on. This had an effect on economies, on the history of the fate of nations, and germs especially were devastating.
Sure.
The Indians had no immunity to smallpox, for example, unlike his sailors. So hundreds of thousands of Indians died as a result of catching this disease. Also, the collision of spiritual beliefs or systems was devastating for the Indians. They originally greeted the arrival of Columbus on the first voyage or two with a sense of acclaim, according to their thinking, as best we can figure out. This was fulfilling a prophecy that some ships would descend from heaven and inaugurate a new age for them. Well, it was a new age, but not a very happy one. And they expected the Columbus and his men eventually to leave, to sail on and not come back. But Columbus, of course, was what we would now call an imperialist, and wanted to found a colony on the island of Hispaniola, which is the Dominican Republic and Haiti, of course. And when they realized that Columbus and his men weren't going anywhere, or that he was going to leave and then come back, which is what he did, they fell into a kind of despair, because they thought that he was occupying their ancestral homelands. And more than that, their idea of morality was, or conventional morality was different from ours, and they freely shared their women, for example, with Columbus's men. Columbus's men began having children with the women who they found in the New World, and whom they also found very attractive. And then the Indians fell into despair over that as well, because they felt that the future of their people was being diverted or even stolen. At least we get that sense from Columbus's writing. And their reaction was horrifying. They began committing suicide by the thousands and tens of thousands. They took poison herbs. They jumped off of cliffs. And I mean, Columbus just couldn't believe this. He wrote about this in numb disbelief in his diaries. How could this possibly be happening? When he set out on this voyage, which was to establish a trade route to China, he certainly had no interest in genocide and slaughtering large numbers of people, or even any people. The orders that he carried with him from Ferdinand and Isabella explicitly said he was to treat anybody that he found in a kind and just manner.
Well, that sure didn't happen.
No, it did not happen.
Let me just tell people again and reintroduce you. I'm talking with Lawrence Bergreen. His incredible Columbus, the Four Voyages, 1492 to 1504, has just come out in paper from Penguin. You can go to columbusfourvoyages.com. This has three illustration inserts and full-color maps. Lawrence Bergreen, let me back you up just to when Columbus left, and he convinces the king, queen, not of Spain, right?
Of Spain.
Okay. And this little tale of how the queen had to pawn her jewelries. They were kind of broke, weren't they? I mean,
well, I'll back up even a little bit more. Columbus, of course, was originally from Genoa, Italy, and he was part of a large diaspora from Genoa of mariners like him who were looking for work. Genoa was a tiny place, and it was having financial difficulties. First, he went to Portugal. No luck there. And then he went on to Spain. Ferdinand and Isabella were looking for mariners to back some sort of voyage to China across the water to emulate Marco Polo, but do it more quickly. They were broke because they had just finished the Inquisition. So they had expelled the Moors, who we now call the Muslims, from Spain, and the Jews. And in the process, they had impoverished their country because both of material and intellectual resources. This was both a brain and material drain. So Columbus, among others, was trying to fill a vacuum. So they gave him the commission. And, if Isabella pawned her jewels, and it's not clear she did, this was more of a symbol than an actuality. The voyage wasn't that expensive to back. It was three leased ships. Nobody thought he would return because other people had tried to sail across the Atlantic, or as it was known in its day, the Ocean Sea. Nobody had ever made it back. So when Columbus set out, nobody really gave much chance of ever seeing the guy again. And yet 3.5 weeks later, he bumped into land. We still don't know which island it was. There were 6 or 8 candidates in the Leeward Islands, in the general area of the Bahamas. That might be the first landfall that Columbus made. We're not sure. There's no artifact like a cross or a coin or something that would tie him to, you know, any particular beach or shoal or anything. But anyway, we do know that he was there. He kept a detailed log, although curiously enough, he didn't want other people following in his track. And so he disguised his location. So if you were to try and literally follow his footsteps, it would be like a map to a buried treasure which had been altered to throw people off the scent. And that's what Columbus did on these early expeditions of his, because he didn't want copycats. Anyway, then he got back to Spain and a hero's welcome, and a few months later, was off again. Ferdinand and Isabella were hoping that he would bring back untold wealth from these lands that he had discovered, which he insisted had something to do with China, although everybody else was pretty skeptical about. So he kept looking for gold. He found a little gold. He found fool's gold. He found some gold that had been washed out of the soil in mountains, but he never found the gold mines that he thought he would. He was a very religious person, and his interpretation of the Bible was a literal one. He thought he might actually find King Solomon's mines on this voyage or something like it. Of course, he didn't. Now, he brought back enough gold nuggets to convince Ferdinand and Isabella that there was more to be found. So that's why they kept sending him back, hoping to find more and more of that. And that's where the myth of El Dorado, of the New World having, you know, the El Dorado took root. It really didn't flourish until as recently as the 19th century and the Gold Rush, which was finally the fulfillment of this myth or conviction that had driven Columbus several centuries early. It's kind of incredible when you think about it. So here was a guy who was seriously confused about what he was doing, where he was, having hallucinations, a brilliant mariner, a rather poor administrator, caught up in this collision of two continents and two ways of life, the Indians, as we now call them, because we thought that they were in India or Asia, and the Europeans. And he didn't really understand what was going on. Neither did anyone else. These forces took rather centuries to become clear. Part of the reason why Columbus is memorable was that although he wasn't the first one to get involved in this race to discover an empire and explore, he was, among other things, the most enthusiastic self-publicizer. At the end of each voyage, he wrote long letters and descriptions trumpeting his accomplishments. They were quickly printed. After all, this was the age of the Gutenberg press, and circulated about around Europe. And so he acquired a reputation even as his rivals were trying to cut him down to size, and even as Ferdinand and Isabella, especially by the second or third voyages, were shaking their head, and they fired him. They actually replaced him. By the time his fourth voyage rolled around, in 1502, 1504, he was sailing on his own account. The island of Hispaniola in the city of Santo Domingo, which he had discovered and he considered his own kingdom and he thought belonged to him, he'd been banished from it. Ferdinand and Isabella appointed another Spanish bureaucrat named Nicolas de Ovando to run it. And when Columbus got there and there was a storm coming, perhaps even a hurricane, Nicolas de Ovando wouldn't let him drop anchor there. So he had been banned from his own land, his own kingdom, incredibly enough.
Well, I was going to say this is all incredible. Lawrence Bergreen is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. The book is Columbus, The Four Voyages, 1492 to 1504, the New York Times bestseller. It's now available in paper from Penguin. A couple of questions, but then I'll shoot them all out to you. One, I'm curious, I just thought of this, how old he was, how long the distance that he traveled. But also, I was, years ago, I read Samuel Eliot Morrison's The European Discovery of America, The Southern Voyages. And as Columbus sailed around the area he was in, he named everything. He was like naming crazy.
Yes.
And I was thinking, I think there's a Yiddish word, chutzpah, that, I mean, these things already had names. But he called him Saint This and Saint That. And can you speak to his age, sure, the distance, and what was all this naming about?
Yes. Columbus, like other explorers of that era, whether it was Magellan and many others, was claiming them for Christendom. So they had names that the Indians had given them, but those were profane names, if you will, and he wanted to give them sacred names. So he would name an island Monte Cristo rather than whatever name the Indians knew it. So he wasn't so much naming as renaming. And, of course, you could say he wasn't discovering anything.
Right.
He was rediscovering it for Spain. But most of the places he went were already settled by the Taino Indians or others, and he was by no means the first person ever to get there. So you have to see everything in a context, in a sense of this cultural relativism from the Indians or Taino's point of view. Columbus and his men were great intruders, and they were trespassing on their territory. So and they were outsiders, and Columbus felt this sense of otherness, of estrangement, of not belonging, and it was haunting to him. How do I know this? Well, we know it because he wrote about it in his diaries, and other men wrote about it. They felt that when they would come on to an island and they would see the Indian encampments, and it was chilling because all the Indians had fled. They had even left their fires still burning. They were still warm and still smoking, but they were so afraid of or appalled by the Europeans that at the first sign of them, they left. They fled. Occasionally, Columbus writes of finding a small child that one family group of Indians had left behind, you know, crying that he had been forgotten in the commotion. So Columbus had rescued him from this abandonment. So, you know, rather than being attacked by the Indians or eaten because there was a fear that they were cannibals, the Indians couldn't put enough distance between them and these horrifying European intruders with their big ships and their guns and their horses and their dogs. None of these things existed in the New World at that point.
Well, that was a sensible reaction. I mean, obviously.
Yes, it was a sensible reaction. And Columbus didn't regard them as being inferior beings. Quite the opposite. He was remarked on how graceful they were, how well adapted, well, how could it be otherwise, to their surroundings, how easy their life was, how stately they were. He was struck over and over again by their stately and dignified bearing, even though they were nearly naked, which was very, very startling by European standards. And many of the men were struck by how beautiful the women were. And when they did overcome their fear and relate to the Spaniards, they were often quite generous as well, which was perhaps somewhat naive. So Columbus was, very conflicted about much of what he found. When he would write descriptions of vegetation and animals, local animals, in his book, he groped for the words, the proper words, because he had never seen anything like it before, and said he was on the verge of tears because there were no words to describe these new forms of life that he was seeing. And it's very poignant. He was moved and in a way kind of terrified by what he was finding. Why would they be different? It's because of evolution, because the old world and the new had been on separate evolutionary tracks for eons, and plants and animals had taken on different forms that were similar to but not identical to those that Columbus and his sailors were familiar with in the old world. And so he was amazed that there was this variety, seemingly endless profusion of life that you know was all new to him, whether it was a pineapple or a dog that didn't bark, or an iguana. The Indians were eating iguana as a delicacy. This was terrifying to Columbus and his men. They thought the iguanas were little dragons.
Well, they are. They were, in a way. You know, you have written about people who went way beyond their geography. Marco Polo, Magellan. Yeah. You've written about the voyage to Mars. In some ways, these musical figures went beyond what was current. This is maybe an odd question. Would the world have been better if Columbus would have stayed at home, given what followed?
Well, you know, if Columbus had stayed at home, this was going to happen anyway. You know, he put his stamp on it, or the process of history did over the years, kind of drafted him into the role, you know, with this belated establishment of Columbus Day in 1937. But if he hadn't gone, Alonso Ojeda of Amerigo Vespucci and a number of other navigators would have done more or less the same thing. They would have put their own spin on it, but the same kinds of things were happening with other explorers as well. So it was an historical event whose time has come. And it's interesting. It makes you think, well, is history really impersonal forces, or is it really actions of men? And in Columbus's case, you see him trying to adopt or personify historical forces and appropriate them for his own ends. But it was bound to happen at that time.
Well, it's, and, you know, interestingly, the Tano people that you mentioned that Columbus first were discovered by, I always like to say, were completely eliminated. They disappeared.
Terrible.
Yet in Cuba today, there is a grouping of people that claim they're the direct descendants.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's a same. I'm in New York, and there is a Taino revival where there are some people trying to reclaim this lost heritage. And it was generally considered that Taino were wiped out, or there were just a few dozen left. And you know, whether this is how much substance there is to this reclamation of their lost ancestry, I don't know. But it's a tragic story. Now, I have to add that Columbus did not intentionally kill them all. He didn't say, okay, we're going to wipe out the Taino. We're going to get them. They're our enemies. It didn't happen like that at all. He saw them as potential allies or resources. And most of them died because of smallpox, which they caught. And Columbus had no idea of infecting them. Nobody understood the mechanism of transmitting diseases that way. So it was accidental. It was a tragic accident. So that's part of why this encounter is so heartrending in a way.
Well, let's do this. We, unfortunately, for the radio audience, are completely out of time, but for the reading audience, the book is right here. It's Columbus, The Four Voyages, 1492 to 1504. Lawrence Bergreen is the author and has been my guest. It's in paper now. It's issued by Penguin. You can go to columbus4voyages.com, or you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and there'll be a link to that. A fascinating story. We think we know it all, and there is so much left unsaid that is in this book. Lawrence Bergreen, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. Rockin' Detroit at 101.1 FM and the rest of the planet online at WRIF.com. This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
Thank you.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, if I told many of you that there was going to be a conference at Wayne State University towards the end of this month called the North American Labor History Conference, I bet there'd be a lot of... It doesn't sound real exciting on the face of it. And to be quite honest, in past years, it hasn't been very, very academic. And, you know, not there's anything wrong with that. I mean, academics want to talk to one another, present their research and their history to one another and what have you. But it's been taken over in terms of the direction by a friend of mine, someone who's been a guest on this program before, Professor Fran Shore from the Department of History at Wayne State University. And this year's North American Labor History Conference is pretty exciting. You can go to its website, and I'll have a link on this, nalhc.wayne.edu. And I say I'll have a link on my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E. And for the weeks to come, I'm going to be interviewing some of the speakers that are there because I'm just all excited. You know, like you go to a rock concert and you get a look at the whole list of all the bands that are going to be there. Well, same with this as well. There's incredibly interesting speakers, keynotes, panels, you name it. A cultural night where there's going to be a lot of music and poetry and stuff like that. One exciting speaker is Marina Citrin. She's a writer, and this is how she describes herself, a writer, lawyer, teacher, organizer, militant, and dreamer. I'm going to really ask her about those last two things. She's written any number of books. She's the editor of a book called Horizontalism, Voices of Popular Power in Argentina. And you go, whoa, you know, hey, we live in Detroit. We're going to hook this up, okay? That was from 2006. And she has just completed for Zed Press, Everyday Revolutions, Horizontalism and Autonomy in Argentina. And again, we're going to connect this up as well with what's happening in Detroit and around the world. And Marina Citrin has traveled a lot. She's lived in Cuba. She's traveled extensively throughout the world. She's written for Yes Magazine, for The Nation, for Dissent, the Journal of Aesthetics and Protest, all over the planet as her travels take her as well. Marina Citrin is at her office in Brooklyn, and we reach her there. Marina, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Great to be here. Hi.
Hi. And I didn't even give all of your creds. I mean, that would take about a third of the program. Let's just barrel into this and begin with a couple of questions that people might wonder about. And the first is your concept of horizontalism. And of course, you're looking at Argentina, but it has widespread manifestations even here in the United States, right?
It does, exactly. And it's actually, you know, I can't really take credit for the concept. It's something, it's really a practice, and it's something that in Argentina in 2001, they had a total economic crisis, which is going to sound familiar to a lot of people, you know. And from the crisis, people went out in the streets, and what they did at first was bang pots and pans, called a cacerolazo in Spanish, but, you know, and not organized by political parties or anyone. They just went out banging pots and pans, saying they all have to go, just totally fed up with the government and feeling that everybody was responsible for this crisis, which, you know, in a lot of ways they were. And then from there, organizing, you know, not looking to the government to figure things out, you know, that the government really had made enough problems as it was and all kind of institutions of power. So people began to organize these assemblies and stand together and look to one another and make decisions together. And that's actually where the word in Spanish, it's horizontalidad. And it didn't exist before in Spanish. It came out of 2001 in Argentina, reflecting this horizontal relationship. And it really is, as it sounds, where people look across at one another, not up, not for someone to tell them what to do, but people deciding together, horizontally, and kind of figuring out what that means.
Now, that's the opposite of hierarchical relations, up and down. I mean, people
it's
at the top.
It's the opposite of hierarchical. And, you know, in Argentina in those first years, people didn't use the language of hierarchical or direct democracy. It was really just we're horizontal because we're tired of these kind of vertical people telling us what to do. And I think that's what there's some. It's so similar to what's been going on over the past year or two all around the world with all the different occupies and what's been happening in Spain and in Greece and people really just saying enough and we're going to look to one another and try to figure things out for ourselves. And in fact, some people even use the word horizontal to talk about what they're doing because a lot of the old words just aren't sufficient to explain this relationship, I think.
Why Everyday Revolutions, though, the title of your just published book? Because usually there's been great leaders in revolutions, George Washington or V.I. Lenin or Fidel Castro or something like that. What makes it everyday? Or is it the horizontalism that does?
Well, it's both. I mean, it is related to the horizontal relationships and people looking to one another, and then thinking about revolution not as, you know, it's kind of that same, we're not going to look to these institutions that got us into this problem in the first place, whether that's, you know, banks or the state, and we're going to look to one another in this horizontal way. And then the same thing then with when you're looking at longer term change, not seeing revolution then as that moment, okay, we take over the state or the White House, or in Argentina it's the Pink House, and then what? You know, you're stuck with the same institutions and probably a lot of the same players and the same kind of relationships that existed before in the system. So looking at revolution as a much different kind of process. And so that, you know, in Argentina there were moments where people, you know, the government fled, four governments fled actually, with so many people in the street just banging pots and pans, this massive rebellion. And people made a choice not to go in and take over the government, saying that power is somewhere else. Power is in the neighborhood. Power is in the workplaces. You know, people took over their workplaces and ran them and continue to run them together. They call it recuperating, you know, kind of taking back what's yours, using this horizontal form. But that's where power is, not in just getting new senators or new people in the state. And I think that's also, again, what we're seeing just in the past few days, the protests. You know, hundreds of thousands of people have been out on the street in Spain, and they're definitely, you know, protesting against the cuts, but they're also not believing that the government can fix it. So the last massive mobilization started with assemblies in neighborhoods. Then people converged on the parliament building to surround it, not to take it over, but to say that basically everyone in parliament was under arrest and that that wasn't legitimate power anymore. So it's, again, that, like, power is somewhere else, and then to go back and organize in the neighborhoods.
You know, there in the United States, we're at a period where we're really involved in sort of examination of hierarchical relationships, well, in a lot of spheres, but certainly in the electoral sphere. So we're hoping one leader gets in as opposed to another. We have these hopes that one leader, one the president, will fix everything, and other people think, well, the current guy hasn't fixed everything, so, you know, another group of people are thinking, we hope that the other guy is going to fix it. I mean, it's not that simple. I know there's a lot of other stuff going on, but certainly in the United States, a sense of horizontalism hasn't taken on any mass expression, or has it?
You know, I actually think it has. It's not in the same as Argentina, for example, and we're not yet taking over our workplaces and running them together without bosses and hierarchy. But in the elections, to talk to most people, I think people are voting because they want to, you know, prevent one person from being elected or certain policies from being instituted. But it's not really a proactive, positive thing. I'm voting because I believe that this will happen or change will happen or something will happen through that kind of politics. It's more of a kind of, I'm going to hold my nose and do this. But I don't think most people think that's really where politics is. You know, in Spain they have one of the main slogans is no nos representan, that they don't represent us. And in Russia they say they don't represent us and they can't even imagine us. Like, it's this distancing from electoral politics. And that's, to me, not a contradiction with voting. I think, especially in swing states, yeah, keep out the ultra-bad, sure. But then go back and organize where we can actually change things, because the government really ignores what we want. People organize or protest around certain things, and we're ignored. But when we take action, that's different. So, like, in the United States, in so many places, I've been to a few cities where, you know, so many people are losing their homes and evictions are taking place and, you know, homes are being auctioned, and it's just outrageous that it's happening, because it's really on all of these illegitimate mortgages that the banks put forward. But what neighbors are doing is coming together with each other. So you could call it horizontal, but it's just, horizontal is also just the most natural thing. So you go and you talk to your neighbor or somebody you work with or study with and try to figure out what to do. And so around housing, what a lot of people have been doing is talking to their neighbors and finding out, well, who's at risk of losing their house, and do they want their neighbors to organize with them? And so in a lot of these places, neighbors are organizing together, and then when it actually comes time for an eviction, they prevent it. They sit outside the home. This was in Minnesota and in California and in New York. It's been happening all over, sitting outside the home and preventing the eviction from taking place. And then through the mobilization, the bank doesn't even know what to do, but they're kind of freaked out that this might take off, I think, across the entire United States, and everyone resists. So they're renegotiating people's mortgages. So, you know, it's not perfect, but it's preventing people from losing their homes. Or in Brooklyn and Queens, you know, in Housing Quartier, what has been happening a lot is when there's an auction, people go in and sing. It's very much like in the civil rights movement, kind of singing gospel-like songs, but with lyrics, you know, towards the auctioneer, but saying, don't auction this house. Huh. And by doing it, they disrupt the whole process, and the house doesn't get auctioned. So the family gets another 30, 60, 90 days. The court gets really backed up here. So, again, not perfect, but this is kind of neighbors horizontally organizing with each other to keep people in their homes. And that seems a lot more, you know, like real politics than, you know, we could vote somebody into office, but are they really going to help us keep our homes?
Yeah, and that's happened in happening in Detroit as well. There's been any number of home defenses, stopping disabled veterans from being having their houses taken out from under them. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is Marina Citron. You can go to her website, which is has a lot of incredible material on it. It's Marina, and the last name is Citron, Citrin.com. There'll also be a link on my website, Peter Werbe, Werbe.com. And Marina Citron, I didn't mention, has a doctorate in jurisprudence from CUNY Law School and a PhD in global sociology from Stony Brook University as well. And on your website, Marina Citron, you mention you're a writer, lawyer, teacher. That's you get that from the degrees, but then organizer, militant, and dreamer. Now that doesn't sound much like a doctor of jurisprudence and a PhD. tell us about the militant. Sometimes it's got a kind of a bad. I was almost surprised to see it there because sometimes it has a bad connotation to some people. You know that's what they call terrorists, right? That's kind of like a synonym.
In some parts of the world, yeah. I don't think that's true. I think militant to me is being really strong and firm in my beliefs and acting on them. So being an activist just feels too, I don't know, the word just doesn't feel strong enough. I think being a militant, you know, what comes up in my mind is someone who is really strong and firm and willing to dedicate themselves to their beliefs and to be taken seriously.
And is, and is dreamer like John Lennon's Imagine?
The dreaming is based on the militancy and based on real things. I mean, I am a dreamer because I'm constantly, you know, imagining this other world. But I see it all the time in little places. I mean, when you talk about horizontalism or everyday revolutions, that this change, people acting together to help each other to change the world, we see all the time. And so that's kind of the seeds for dreaming. So seeing that new world all the time, but dreaming it, because we have to walk toward something that we imagine.
You know, the reason I, well, you finished with the word I was going to use, the reason I used the phrase about John Lennon is that both of us have traveled to Cuba, me for a week at a time, you living there for a couple of years, and I'm, without even asking, I'm sure you've been to John Lennon Park, where the words to imagine are on the, in brass and the cement. And when I was there, I was with this guy, and he says, well, now do you want to go to V.I. Lennon Park? I said, no, I'm going to pass on that one. But those words from John Lennon in Cuba, and actually I always thought that that was the kind of this dichotomy within Cuba, John Lennon and V.I. Lennon. I mean, this seems to be like two different worlds of change. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, it is two worlds of change, and actually the Beatles were banned in Cuba in the first years of the revolution.
Right, during the 60s, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so it actually it symbolizes even more, you know, kind of the change from one Lenin to another, perhaps. Not so much coming from the government, though the government's allowing the space for change. And when I talk about change, I'm not meaning this, you know, people in Miami like to scream about, you know, the dictatorship and how they just need to bring capitalism to Cuba and then, you know, everything will be happy and free market and everything else. And then, of course, everyone will lose their homes like they're losing their homes in the United States. So that's not really the kind of change that Cubans are looking for or that I think would be good for Cuba. But people are talking more about, like, this conversation on horizontalism. People are talking about more collective running of workplaces or having more local power in their neighborhoods and kind of shifting where power is located. So maybe the shifting from one Lenin to another would be a really good way to think about it, and that, you know, there aren't tons and tons of people organizing, but people are, and they're trying to figure out how to change things without going in this horrible direction of, say, the U.S. or China, where all you do is work and work and work and work and work, and then you're still in debt, and then you have to work more, and you're still in debt. You know, that whole pattern that
sure.
many of us know so well. And that, because in Cuba they don't now. People don't work many hours a day, and you get time off for so many things, from having children, or if you're sick, or if your partner's sick, or, you know, it's a much more civilized society, I think, in that way, in prioritizing human life, but it has a lot of other problems. So trying to bring the priority of human life and people together with local power is, I think, the shift that a lot of people in the society, when I'm talking about change, I'm talking about, you know, people at the base and in neighborhoods and in schools and stuff like that.
That's a lot of what I saw when I was there. Marina Citron, my guest, has just published Everyday Revolutions, Horizontalism and Autonomy in Argentina. The value of this, just it's more than just an interesting story. It also, and as I think as Marina has been saying, it acts as a model. When we see what other people are doing, then it becomes obvious to us other things are possible other than what is now. Marina Citron will also be at the North American Labor History Conference. That's going to be at Wayne State University, October 18th through the 20th. And you can go to nalhc.wayne.edu. That's probably a mouthful. You go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and you can hook into the full program, which is extraordinarily extensive, very, very interesting speakers. And Marina Citron, you're going to be on a panel on Friday called Mediterranean Insurgencies, where you're going to be talking about Spain. And then on Saturday, you're going to be talking about labor and Occupy. Mediterranean Insurgencies, tell me, you've been all over Spain as well. I don't even know this, but now I'm suspecting it, right? I mean,
I've been to Spain and Greece both.
Okay.
Time over the last.
I'm only laughing. I don't know how. I have hardly time to tie my shoes, and you're writing books and getting PhDs, but go ahead.
Well, I'm also one of these people who has so much debt. I'm not even sure what I'm going to do about it. Hopefully, the strike debt campaign will take off nationally, and we'll all kind of renegotiate.
Okay. Well, I want to hear about that some other time for
sure.
Yeah,
that would be an interesting conversation. But it's about what's been going on in Greece and Spain is really so similar to what's been going on with Occupy or with housing and things in the U.S., a similar form of organizing, you know, with each other in horizontal ways in neighborhoods and in workplaces. And then also taking action ourselves, a kind of direct action like around housing, only they're doing it around a lot of other issues, including healthcare in Greece. So we'll be discussing that. And then also discussing actually workers in Greece. Just had someone visit them from Argentina which is really pretty far away. And it's, I don't know, like a 30-hour flight or something. But because workers in Thessaloniki in Greece just decided to take over their workplace and run it themselves. And because there are hundreds of these workplaces, and all kinds of workplaces, I'm talking about like grocery stores, hotels, newspapers, not just kind of the old kind of style factory, even though there are factories as well. But they went to share experiences to help the Greeks in their process of taking over workplaces. So,
what happens to the bosses? I mean, the owners, they're just...
Well, in a lot of these cases, the ones in Argentina, the bosses and the owners are in the process of closing the workplace. So it's usually the workers take it over when they know that it's in the process of being closed, or sometimes it already is closed. But the workers make sure to take it and then occupy it before they can remove the machines,
mm-hmm.
whatever the machines are, depending on the kind of work, so that obviously they can keep producing. Sometimes it's that the workers are owed so much back wages that they choose to recuperate. And then it's more of a fight. And then often when, even though the bosses leave because they couldn't make the company profitable anymore, and then the workers run it, and then it starts to run well, and the workers actually do better, then a lot of the time the bosses get, I don't know if they're embarrassed or what it is, but then they try to get the police involved, and they try to evict the workers because, you know, if they couldn't run the workplace and the workers are running it better, I guess that makes them look bad. But so far the workers have been successful in all of these workplaces in Argentina, and the bosses don't come back. And they run it themselves, so sharing that experience with Greece, so I might talk a little bit about what the Greeks are doing in that direction.
Well, you know, I think here in the United States, and when we hear these figures about unemployment, and I mean, some of the Republican ads are saying real unemployment and underemployment is like 20%, and that, you know, there's foreclosures and all that. Still, the majority of us, life goes on as before. I mean, I have to say, you know, it has with me and probably most of my friends being, you know, in the middle class, although I understand, you know, what's happening to the middle class. And nobody really ever goes for revolution at first resort. It's always, you know, it's always a last resort. So I wonder how, I don't know what, you know, this conversation, which I think is so important and probably will presage the way many people throughout the world, in fact, they are reacting to the crisis they're experiencing, how probably the majority, at least in the United States, are thinking, wow, this is a little extreme. I mean, what about, you know, me and my neighbors? I mean, you were maybe having a few troubles, maybe an unemployment here, maybe, you know, a house or two foreclosed. But in the main, it's America like it always was. Work and consume. Watch television and root for the Detroit Tigers. Is there anything we can really say to them? Maybe even not. Maybe.
Well, I don't, I mean, I think on the one hand, what you're saying is totally true. But I also think that, you know, and what I love in the slogan of the 99% from the Occupy movement is it makes us feel a kind of pride in being in the 99%, which includes if we've lost our job, if we're losing our home. But it still is a process because for the longest time, you know, in so many places around the world, but especially in the U.S., if you lose your job or you don't have enough money or you're buying groceries on a credit card, you feel shame. And so people don't tell each other. So I think there's a lot more under the surface. You know, whether people are losing their jobs and borrowing from their families, or a lot of people having to move home with their parents who are elderly. And that's happening a lot, and we just kind of cover it up.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think it's happening. And then the idea of revolution isn't, and this is why I like the everyday revolutions. You know, to say revolution, yes, we must build some big organization and have all these big confrontations. And there's kind of this image of, I don't know, the Russian Revolution or the French Revolution or, you know, the American Revolution. And instead to think about it as where power is and that we just, together with our neighbors, start to change things. And we keep each other in our homes. Maybe the movement that stops paying debt to the banks just stops paying to the banks. And we take over our workplaces, which can sound, you know, maybe scary, but that so many tens of thousands of people have been doing it in Argentina, and it's just the most logical thing. Most of the time you know how to run your workplace better than the boss. So just, you know, we continue with life as living with our neighbors and working and everything else. It's just power is located with us rather than with people who are, you know, making our lives much more difficult and taking power from us.
Sure. Marina Citron, we're out of time, except for maybe 60 seconds, and I've a couple of times noted that you're a writer, lawyer, dreamer, organizer, militant, and dreamer. And the dreamer part, that's what interests me considerably, because there aren't the dreams of the ideal society the way they used to be. Most of them have kind of hit the shoals of bad experiences. Like people thought communism could, you mentioned the Bolshevik Revolution could replace capitalism. That turned out to be, you know, a police state. How do we energize dreams? And I don't even know if that's a fair question. I don't know what I would answer if someone asked me that. But any thoughts on that?
We let ourselves dream. I think we just have to free our dreams, I guess, and allow ourselves to imagine the kind of society we'd really want to live in, not one that we're told we should live in, but talk to each other and just imagine the same way we do with our personal lives, and you imagine certain things for your individual life, just imagining that times your neighborhood, times your city, times your country, times the world, and just, you know, freeing your mind to imagine what the world could look like.
Sounds good. Marina Citron has been my guest, and she will be one of the many speakers at the North American Labor History Conference at Wayne State University, October 18th through the 20th. Their website is nalhc.wayne.edu. I'll have a link on my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. More of Marina Citron's writings and thoughts are at her website, marinacitron.com. The last name is S-I-T-R-I-N. Marina Citron, I will see you in Detroit.
Fabulous. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit. Detroit's rock station rocks worldwide. You're listening to WRIF.com. This is 101 WRIF. Thanks for rocking with us online at WRIF.com.
Mike's best moments delivered right to your computer or mobile device. The Drew and Mike Podcast, brought to you by Matt's Jewelry Brokers. For fast cash, call Matt's at 586-286-2866. Subscribe today at WRIF.com. Crow Seal spells rock. W-R-I-F.
I want to rock
everything that rocks.